This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Time for Place to Be Nation's Year in Pop. Each episode, we go back in time to a year in the past and take a trip down memory lane and see what was going on in the worlds of news, sports, and pop culture with your hosts, Andy Atherton and Scott Criscolo.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to another great episode of the Year in Pop here on the PTBN Pop Feed. I am your co-host, Andy Atherton, and thank you for joining us tonight. We have a very exciting year. It's a big year, a huge year, and let's just get to it. Let me bring in my co-host to start things off. He is also the co-host of the Place to Be podcast, the co-host on Main Event, and you hear him on very many shows here all over Place to Be Nation, Mr. Scott Criscolo. Scott, how are you tonight?
I don't remember the last time, Mr. Atherton, that I actually co-hosted a podcast back-to-back days with the same person that didn't live in Rhode Island. So this is actually very unprecedented for you, sir, to be able to actually book each other for consecutive days of a week. But we had a great show last night, and we are going to have a great show this evening. So why don't we dive right in and introduce one of our guests and one of our other esteemed panelists, and I'll introduce the other.
Okay. Joining us, he is the co-host of This Week in Sports, This Week in the NFL, whatever they're calling it this week. Also one of the co-hosts of the ECW Extreme Three-Way Dance here over on the, actually not here, but over on the wrestling feed. And you can hear him on various Pop Goes the Movies and other various shows. Mr. J. Arsenio D'Amato. Johnny, how are you tonight?
Right there, boys. I can't wait to chop it up about an epic year, 77. I can't wait to chop it up with three other wild and crazy guys.
That is correct.
And, of course, concluding our quartet, our four horsemen of the 70-opolix. I was going to try and do it. It didn't work. Anyway, he is the former co-host of Place to Be Nation's Extra Point, Place to Be Nation's Sports Evolution. He is a former and continued guest on the Main Event, and this is like the boner show for him because literally everything he loves is in every segment of the show tonight, and that is, of course, the doctor, Dr. G. George Roblino, who is tonight wearing his Ralph Furley shirt ascot combo, aren't you? You look very good in your ascot tie tonight.
You know what?
You look great in paisley.
I don't know what ascot tie looks like.
Let's have some escargots. Anyway, Doc.
No. I'm looking forward to this show. This is a great show. And even though only 40 years old and a lot of this stuff happened, it's some of the few things in my life that I do remember at that age. You know, I don't know if you guys remember a lot of stuff when you were 3 or 4 years old, but major things like this that happened in this year, I do remember. So I'm looking forward to it.
No, it's huge.
Yeah.
And of course, Mr. D'Amato referenced, and Andy, I got to say, our first five chapters, 1972 through 76, have been exceptional.
Yes.
But this year might be the one that puts us over the top, gets us on the map. I feel like we've been building to this moment.
A crescendo.
What year are we doing, sir?
We're doing 1977, and in our pre-meetings, Scott has been very excited because, you know, I think what it is now, you know, you, I, and George were around the same age. I'm a year older than you guys, and Johnny's a few years older than us. But I think, you know, this is the first year that we have vivid memories. Now, we're like, you know, 4 or 5 years old, and that's, you know, a lot of the things that happened this year have stuck with us, you know, and I think it's and some of this is still going on. Some of these, you know, where they have the conclusion of something that started in 77. In a few months. So it's a great year in terms of music, hometown sports for some of us. And yeah, this is just, we're all very excited. We're, you know, the first five episodes were great, but you know, I think that was like, you know, the practice run, or the, maybe the spring training, if you will, to lead up to a year like 77 that had so much going on and so much great memories for all of us.
Absolutely. I mean, literally every chapter of pop culture, from music, I mean, huge albums that came out in 1977. Dr. G knows what one of them is, as does Mr. D'Amato. And TV, some epic shows that we'll talk about, including probably a miniseries that changed history that came out at, that aired in 77. Mm-hmm. Sports, well, we all know what was going on in the summer of 77. That Dr. G, and of course, something actually happened to the other New York sports team that John and I try to forget, but we will bring it up tonight in baseball in 77. And then, of course, news, because everything great takes place in New York. So we'll talk about that. And then, of course, movies. We all know what movie came out in 77, and then we'll save that for last, of course. But yeah, so Andy, why don't you dive right in? Cost of living, life in 1977. Life. What was life in 77?
Life was like, okay, so just going to run through some stats quickly, right at like the top of the show, just kind of paint the picture of where the country was at. And average cost of a new house, $49,300. That's up about $6,000 from 76. The average income, $15,000 a year, down $1,000 from $16,000.
No surprise there.
Your monthly rent, your average was up to $240, up from $220. The average cost of new car was around $7,000. A gallon of gas was about 65 cents, up from 59 cents. And your inflation rate went up to 6.5%, up from 5.75%. So, you know, we're in the, I guess, the getting towards the middle of Mr. Carter's presidency. So we're seeing how the 70s are going to end. And the 80s are right on the horizon. So things are going to get interesting in terms of these stats. Some popular toys from that year. Throughout the 70s, you know, skateboards and the classic roller skates. You know, you had both kinds, I think. You had the ones that went over your foot, and then you had those metal ones that you put your sneakers in, like kind of attached to them.
Oh, yeah, I remember
those. Oh, my God. Used to tie them around your neck. Yeah.
You know, none since the 70s like sneakers draped along a power line.
Yes.
Slinkies were big. The wooden snow sleds were popular. Were getting popular then.
Yep, I had one.
With the, you know, the metal... what are they called? The metal
blades.
Blades, yes. Thank you. Yep. Matchbox cars, the City Play kit, Raggedy Ann.
Oh, I remember that.
Raggedy Ann and Andy was popular. Of course, you know, being named Andy, I had to go as Raggedy Andy at least once in my childhood. And there are pictures of me and my sister. Yes. Viewmaster. Erector sets were popular. And it's funny, too. You guys know I'm a Disney nerd. Did you know an Erector set was how they came up with the ride vehicle for one of the most popular rides they have down in Epcot today?
I did not know that.
I don't know if you guys are familiar with the ride Soarin'. It's basically what happens is you sit in a kind of a seat, like a long row, and they kind of pull you upwards, and you're kind of dangling from different heights depending on which row you sit in. And there's a huge like IMAX screen, and you move with like a... like a hang glider type camera thing going, and they had it through California, now it's through the world, and they pump in smells and stuff like that, and it's really a fun ride.
Okay, yeah, I remember that.
The Imagineer that was tasked with coming up with the ride system was home. Like, he was, like, you know, banging his head out, you know, like he didn't know what to do, and he was in his parents' house, and he went to the garage and found his old Erector set just playing around with it, and he actually built what the demo of what the Soarin' vehicle really is today. So, you know, watch Martin Marvels on the History Channel, Walt Disney World, and you'll see it, him tell that story. And he actually does have the prototype in front of him when he tells it. So it's quite fascinating, you know. So encourage kids to play with stuff. Kids don't play with enough stuff like that anymore. You know, who knows what they could do. The Play Batmobile, Punch Me Toys. Now, I never knew that was the name of those things. You remember the like the balloon thing with the bottom that's got a little weight to it, and you punch them, and they come back up, punch them, come back up. Yeah, I didn't know they were called Punch Me
Toys. I had a Rocky one.
Yeah, everybody had, like, a clown or something. Or
I had a Rocky one.
portable 8-track players, and portable radio cassettes. Those were also popular. The Atari 2600 was first released in September of that year, the first major home console. Originally launched with 9 different games and was sold for $199, 2 joysticks, and a game cartridge for Combat. I remember playing Combat quite a bit.
I don't remember it being out that long ago, because I remember getting it in the 80s.
Yeah, well, the 2600 was out for a while. 5200, I want to say, wasn't until at least 81, 82, because I remember getting my Intellivision in 79, or the Sears version, and I got the Atari expansion pack for my ColecoVision. So, I can see that. I mean, it became more popular in 1980 with the release of the game Space Invaders.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually the early video market game crashed in 1984 and discontinued in the 90s. Now, also what came out that year, and I remember having these in grammar school, the first all-in-one personal computer, the Commodore PET, was introduced as a prototype at the Consumer Electronics Show in that year. It stood for Personal Electronic Transactor. It was first PC to be sold to retail customers and originally priced at $495. So, we had those in my grammar school. And it was funny, too. We had a little football league because it was a game that came on a cassette. And it was one of those kind of games where you would punch in like a number. And depending on, you know, what your opponent punched in is what happened. And I drafted low. So, actually, I think it was the Houston Oilers. So, in terms of picks for my teams. It was a big year, it looks like, though, for computer and computer-type stuff. The first Apple II computers were sold that year. Unlike Apple I, these actually went on sale for a base price of $1,298.
Yeah, that's like 80 grand now.
Yeah, and these things are worth a mint now if you have one. There's not a lot around today. I think there's maybe 40, I think, or so intact, from what I understand. We're going to just touch on a couple of music stories that we'll go into a little later during our music segment. Record company EMI sacked the controversial UK punk group, the Sex Pistols. And then the king of rock and roll, Elvis Presley, is found dead of an apparent heart attack at the age of 42. So we'll talk on the death of the king a little bit later in the show. But some other notable deaths. This one was Peter Finch. It was in the New Movie Network. I believe he was the first posthumous Oscar because he died.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Freddie Prinze.
I'm mad as hell. And I'm not going to
take it anymore.
What a fucking amazing movie. Mm-hmm. Absolutely amazing movie. Yes. We talked about it in the last episode. Amazing movie.
Mm-hmm. Freddie Prinze of Chico and the Man fame unfortunately committed suicide. The legendary actress Joan Crawford passed away. Alan Reed, better known as the original voice of Fred Flintstone, Werner von Braun passed away. The great Groucho Marx died in 77. Sebastian Cabot, who was a great actor and also you Disney fans, he was the voice of Bagheera in The Jungle Book.
He was also in the Mr. French in Family Affair. Yep. Yeah. And he was also the second Santa Claus in the second version of Miracle on 34th Street.
Ah.
So, just to let you know that. Mm-hmm. So, he's doing a lot of stuff.
Yeah, Zero Mostel, a very funny actor in the original Producers. The legendary.
Producers, yes. A classic.
Yes. I love, everybody should see that. I mean, I do think Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick did a great job, but you got to see that original with him and Gene Wilder.
A classic.
It's next level comedy. Bing Crosby passed away also.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's when him and David Bowie probably did Little Drummer Boy that year, because I remember I heard it was like right before his death.
Keep reading it, and I'll look it up.
Yeah, and of course the great Charlie Chaplin also passed away. Some notable births from 1977: Mr. Tom Hardy, a great actor; Miss Jessica Chastain. We're going to see a lot of superheroes in this list: Michael Fassbender, otherwise known as Magneto; Orlando Bloom; Liv Tyler; Milo Ventimiglia; Sarah Michelle Gellar; Scott, Mr. Tom Welling from Smallville.
Oh, Clark Kent.
Mm-hmm. Maggie Gyllenhaal, Cal Penn, the very funny John Oliver, a couple of very attractive actresses, Kerry Washington and Jamie Presley, the late Brittany Murphy, and the train wreck that is Screech, Dust, and Diamond. The Cake Boss, born in 77, Buddy Velastro, Donald Trump Jr., born in 77. We go into the world of music. We got Kanye, Shakira, Chris Martin, John Mayer, Robin Thicke, Ludacris, 2 Chainz, Jason Mraz, Psy, remember Gangnam Style? Joey Fatone, Fiona Apple, and Gavin DeGraw. And then, you know, in the world of sports, we had Mr. Tom Brady, who I know, but you can't argue with his success. Floyd Mayweather Jr.
A lot of 2.
We got Vince Carter.
0-3. No, we like DC.
Paul Pierce, Layla Ali, Manu Ginobili, Randy Moss, Kerry Strug, Stephon Marbury, and Misty May Traynor. And then finally, some other births in the world of wrestling, since Place to Be Nation is founded originally in wrestling. Mr. John Cena, born in 77, as well as the Beast, Brock Lesnar. The phenomenal one, AJ Styles. Jeff Hardy. Alberto Del Rio. I can't roll my R's. Del Rio. Bobby, Don't Call Me Robert Roode. And his former tag team partner in America's Most Wanted. I wish they could have brought those guys together to WWE. Mr. The Cowboy, James Storm. Miss Gail Kim. The great, she's becoming quite the actress, better known as Awesome Kong, but Miss Kia Stevens. I mean, I could actually see her going in the, you know, the Monique, Gabrielle Sibouye, where they get that, like, that one great character part, and she just blows us all away. So hopefully good things to come for, Kia. And then Titus O'Neil. So,
okay.
Scott,
so I looked it up. Mm-hmm. I looked it up. Bing Crosby's Merry Old Christmas special aired on November 30th, 1977 on CBS. It was shot 5 weeks before Bing's death. Bing died on October 14th of 77. And the special was introduced by his widow, Catherine Crosby, and was broadcast in the U.S. on November 30th. And the U.K. aired it on Christmas Eve. And it was at this special that he sang Peace on Earth / Little Drummer Boy with David Bowie. So it aired here, and it was shot – it said 5 weeks before, so it was probably shot like right around Labor Day weekend probably in 77, and then Bing died on October 14th, and it aired on CBS here in the States on November 30th. So, yes, it actually – the special actually aired posthumously. So when that went to air, we watched Bing and Bowie sing, Bing was already dead.
Yes. Wow.
Which is kind of nuts. So,
but that's going to wrap up our little pop culture start of our show, and we're going to move on to the world of sports with Mr. Criscolo. Scott, take it away.
Thank you, Andy. And well, we did have Dr. G here because he was so looking forward to 77, but then you said Brock Lesnar was born and now he just left. So let's sports in 1977. Holy fucking shit, do we have a big segment right here. We might as well get it out of the way. Let's begin in baseball, where in the Hall of Fame that year, only one guy went in on the non-veterans committee. That one guy, I believe he is one of my dearest friend, Mr. Steve Willey's favorite guys of all time. His nickname was Mr. Cub. Of course, the great Ernie Banks went into the Hall of Fame in 1977. On the veterans committee, Al Lopez, who I think pitched for the Yankees, Amos Roussey, Joe Sewell, and the Negro Leagues committee inducted Martin Digo and John Henry Lloyd. The division winners in 77, of course, the Yankees won the East for the second straight year. The Phillies won the NL East. Kansas City, for the second straight year, won the AL West. And the Dodgers won the NL West. Your AL MVP, one of the best pure hitters of all time, Rod Carew of the Twins. Your NL MVP, George Foster of the Cincinnati Reds, who that season became the first guy to hit 50-plus home runs in a season since both Roger and Mickey did it in 1961. He hit 52 home runs that year. Your Cy Young Award winner, probably the first time a closer won it, Dr. G. Sparky Lyle won it for the Yankees in 1977. And Steve Carlton won it for the Phillies and for the National League Cy Young Award. Your Rookies of the Year, two of my favorite pure hitters of all time and probably two of the most surliest guys of all time. The AL Rookie of the Year was Eddie Murray, Steady Eddie, for the Baltimore Orioles, who I had a nice beer named after Eddie Murray this weekend. Dr. G saw the can. and your NL Rookie of the Year, a guy that, Dr. G, you and I met in an airport once, the Hawk, yes. Andre Dawson, for the Montreal Expos. Lou Brock stole his 900th base on September 30th. Lou Brock, the first great base, the second great base stealer. Probably the first one was Maury Wills. Another guy would be a great base stealer when we get to the 1980s. April 6th, the Seattle Mariners. We had a couple of expansion teams, gentlemen. On April 6th, the Seattle Mariners played their first game ever at the King Dome. They got lost 7-0 to the California Angels. Meanwhile, one day later, the Toronto Blue Jays played their first ever game up at Exhibition Stadium. They actually won in the snow. They beat the Chicago White Sox 9-5. So how about that? It's kind of like when the Mets lost to the Rockies in 93. April 15th, the beloved Montreal Expos played their first game ever at the Big O Olympic Stadium, which I stayed in a hotel across the street from but couldn't get into. 57,592, great crowd at the Big O. The Expos lost 7-2 to the Phillies. On May 11th, Ted Turner, the owner of the Atlanta Braves, named himself manager, are you stunned, and skippers the team to a 2-1 loss to the Pirates. Chubb Feeney, the president of the National League, did not pop a Chubb with this move and ordered him to desist. And soon after, owners were banned from managing. That's like Ted Turner running the NWO, apparently. On June 7th, the Chicago White Sox select a future Hall of Famer, gentlemen, Harold Baines, with the number one pick in the draft. Bill Veeck had first seen Baines play Little League ball and had followed his career from there. The Montreal Expos took Bill Gullickson with the second pick, and the Brewers with the third pick took University of Minnesota infielder and one of my favorite guys of all time, Mr. Paul Molitor. With the in the 15th round, I believe it was the Blue Jays selected a BYU player who would eventually not play baseball but end up playing basketball. We'll talk more about him in the 1980s. Mr. Danny Ainge was drafted. I think he was a shortstop, if I remember correctly. Shortstop or third baseman. All right, here we go. The day that Mr. D'Amato and I and many other Met fans around the area will forever call the Midnight Massacre. On June 15th, 1977, Mike Phillips was traded to the St. Louis Cardinals for Joel Youngblood. Dave Kingman was traded to the Padres for minor league pitcher Paul Siebert and Bobby Valentine. But the trade that will forever be remembered on this date, the Reds traded Pat Zachary, Doug Flynn, Steve Henderson, and Dan Norman, chips of greatness, mind you, to the New York Mets for this little-known right-hander that no one had ever heard of that was highly overrated. No, I'm just kidding. The franchise left the Mets, the great, arguably maybe the greatest right-handed pitcher of all time, Mr. Tom Seaver. Just to give us a little background, the Mets sucked the meat missile in 1977. Donald Grant, the general manager of the Mets, was a fucking asshole. And, oh, I'm sorry. Am I using too much creative license? And him and Seaver did not get along. And in the end, instead of acquiescing to the demands of the greatest pitcher in the league, they traded him to the Reds for four fucking bums. Wow. Seemed to be something that would stick with the Mets for the next 40 years. But in any event, just not good. They called Shea Stadium Grant's tomb. Even Mr. D'Amato and I wouldn't walk in for free at this time to watch the Mets play. Shea Stadium average. But just mind you, what really pisses me off the most is 4 years earlier, they were in the fucking World Series. And now look what happens. I think at the time they were like 35 and 60 something or whatever. And Shea Stadium for the rest of the decade would forever be called Grant's tomb. And the rest of the 70s will not be kind to the New York Metropolitan Baseball Club. But in 1980, things would change. We'll get there. Things would change, Mr. D'Amato. We will have smiles on our faces when we get to 1980. Mark my words.
Hard times. Hard times. Also, Dick Young from the Post also played a big role in
that. Oh, he did.
He crapped on Seaver. He took side with management. And
yes, he did.
Was a big part. And at the time, the newspapers were very influential. So a lot of people a lot of people were fans of his, and
yep.
Even though most of the majority was a hated deal, but he was very influential too. The newspapers were crazy at this time. The Post and the Daily News are selling like hotcakes because
yep.
there was a lot of drama. Also, there was some drama in the Bronx, which you'll get to, which sold a lot of papers that year.
I know, right? Drama in the Bronx. I'm stunned. In the sixth inning. I'm ready to talk to the doctor about this one. In the sixth inning, because I've watched Yankee games with this gentleman. In the sixth inning of an NBC televised game against the Boston Red Sox at Fenway Park, New York Yankee manager Billy Martin pulls right fielder Reggie Jackson, who had just signed in the offseason a huge, what was it, five-year deal after playing 1 year with the Orioles, and it replaced him with Paul Blair after Jackson misplaced Jim Rice's fly ball for a double. As Jackson returns to the dugout, he and Martin exchange words, Martin arguing that Jackson had shown up by not hustling on the play. The Yankee manager lunges at Jackson and had to be restrained by Yogi Berra and Elston Howard, with the NBC camera showing the confrontation to the entire country. The Red Sox win 10-4. Dr. fucking G, I've watched more Yankee games with you than I can ever shake a stick at. I know you pretty well. If you and I were our age now in 1977, I know exactly what you would have said. The fucking season's over. We're all going to lose. The fucking Dodgers are great. You would have gone on this whole fucking tirade, wouldn't you have?
Who are you talking about? I tell you that, you know, again, I remember little bits and pieces, you know, of the team then, but what a nightmare. And to think that team was such a mess for and they won the World Series those 2 years. I can't imagine in today's world, think about it with Twitter and Facebook and all the stuff and the way the media is. I don't think those teams could have won under those circumstances today. If those, you know, with all that stuff that was going on, I don't know if you guys agree, disagree, whatever, but I just think it would have been too much. I think it would have been constant. And with scrutiny as it was at that time, could you imagine now? It would be interesting to see because, you know, fandom has changed over the years. Do you think Reggie would have been as loved today as he was back then? I don't know.
It was still, even though it wasn't all the social media, it was still that replay was shown millions of times on all the news and everything. So it wasn't. Yeah, it wasn't like it was hidden or anything. Everybody knew about it, but it was just one incident. They were still a great team. I mean, even today, you still see, what was it? Even though they suck, Davis from the Orioles went after and his manager went at it. And you've seen, what was it, a couple of years ago, Papelbon and Bryce Harper like threw down in a dugout. You see guys get beefs and you know, and even some on winning teams. You know, I can't recall any right now, but in recent memory. But it was just a one day, and that just fueled the fire. They were just too talented that you know, they were able to overcome that.
I try to think like if you know the Steinbrenner of years ago was around like now, or the way I mean, imagine him with a Twitter.
Oh Jesus! Him and Trump would have had like. You know, constant one-upmanships.
Yeah, but even without Twitter, like I said, back then the Daily News and the Post were huge, and that summer with a lot of more stuff that we're going to get into. That was the papers were selling like hotcakes. Everybody had either a Post or Daily News to read about what was going on between the sports and the other drama that we'll get to outside of the sports. So. Mm-hmm. Even without the social media, people would tune into their 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock news and
yep.
and get all the drama.
Picks 11. Dr. G, what paper was in your house? The Daily News or the Post?
Both. My dad used to get both.
Yeah, Johnny, you too? Or did you have news? Well, you probably had Newsday too, right? Was Newsday around the late 70s?
Definitely. We were a Newsday family, but yeah, we were a Newsday family.
Okay.
You couldn't get a Newsday, you know, in the boroughs, like, you know.
Yeah,
like,
Strong Island only. Strong Island only.
Yeah, remember when, and then they tried to get into the boroughs more like in the 80s, and then they kind of went back to being more of a Long Island paper again.
Yeah.
What did you read, Andy?
I think my parents had the Daily News delivered And then my father would always pick up the post while he was on, like, when he went on his way to work to do his lotto tickets or whatever, you know. Yeah, my parents.
Yeah, sports guys always rock the post. Post are the best sports.
I mean, and between that and then, you know, the Wall Street Journal and friggin', you know, the Westchester paper and then, you know, my parents later on, the Sports Eye. I mean, there's still stacks of papers that my father reads every day. I don't know how he's the time.
Yep. Our paper, we had at the time, I mean, they merged by it, but there were two papers actually in New Haven County. There was the New Haven Register, which is still around today, and then there was the Journal Courier. And I remember my dad actually kind of leaned towards the Journal Courier and then ended up getting bought by the Register, and then and that was like in 87 or 88, and then there was only one paper, and it's a fucking rag now anyway. But my dad would buy the Post or the Daily News, usually the Post, when there was a cool sports background, like even if like when I like if it was like in the 80s when we get to the 80s and we get to the Mets and stuff, my dad would buy me the post for me if there was a cool Mets on the back or
well, remember,
or if there was cool Rangers.
Remember, I mean, obviously we're going out of the 70s, but in the 80s, do you guys remember in the Sunday papers? I want to say it was the Daily News. They used to do the little posters in between.
They
used to put it up on the Yankees and the Mets.
Well, every year it was like a different thing. Like one year it was like all the a picture of all the one year was characters, another year was, you know, the championship teams, another year was there. You know, they did something different every year.
Doc and Darryl. Yep. Doc and Darryl, actually. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we'll get to more of the Yankees in a minute. The All-Star game was at the stadium for the first time in, I think, 15 years or something. Don Sutton won the MVP. The National League won the All-Star game. In the second game of a doubleheader in Boston, the Tigers debuted their new second baseman, Lou Whitaker, and their new shortstop, Alan Trammell. They would play side-by-side guys for 19 seasons and establish a new Major League record for tandem play at those positions.
Wow.
Speaking of Dave Kingman, on September 15th, the Angels traded Kingman to the Yankees. Jesus, you guys always picked up the scrubs. for pitcher Randy Stein. Having also played with the Mets and Padres, obviously, the divisions changed in 1995, but he would be the only player in Major League history to play in all four divisions in the same season. Isn't that crazy? Including both New York teams. I bet you that's rarely happened, too.
Kingman was no scrub. Kingman was no scrub, though, Scott.
No, I know he was.
All or nothing.
Yeah, I know he was, and he was
As a matter of fact, wasn't he the first guy for the longest to not be in the Hall of Fame?
Yeah, I think so. No,
the 500, you know, first guy to have 500 and not be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, that's because he was a 218 hitter and he was a fucking nut job. But no, he wasn't a scrub.
I don't think he hit 500 though.
Okay, but he had for a while he had the most home runs of anybody not in the Hall of Fame. Yeah,
exactly.
Before the Reuters.
Yeah.
He hated reporters. There was a female reporter that he put a rat in a gift box and he sent it to her. Real scumbag. Yeah,
he pulled out a rat and Zeke Moa pulled out his cobra. Anyway,
he had 236 with 442 home runs.
Wow, that's a lot.
And only 1,210 RBI. So it shows you he was, you know, typically all or nothing.
He also played on teams that never had anybody on base either. Also on that day, Earl Weaver pulls his Orioles from the field at Exhibition Stadium, citing hazardous conditions caused by a small tarp weighed down by bricks covering the bullpen mound. They forfeited the game to the Blue Jays. All right. In the postseason, of course, the Dodgers defeated the Phillies. The Yankees beat the Royals for the second straight year. And the 1977 World Series, the New York Yankees and the Los Angeles Dodgers, they met, of course, many, many times. I believe the last time they faced each other, the Dodgers finally got their comeuppance, if I remember correctly, 1955. Dodgers beat the Yankees, the Dodgers' only world championship in Brooklyn. And I don't think they played each other since. But 1977, Yankees-Dodgers, and in Game 6, Reginald Martinez Jackson, the aforementioned guy who doesn't run out fly balls, hits three home runs in three straight pitches. The Yankees win 8-4 and their 21st World Series championship.
And he didn't feel like running, so that's why he hit the home run.
No, of course he didn't. Yeah. The Hall of Famers, I mean, we'll probably say these names again the following season. Al Downing, Charlie Huff, Don Sutton, Rick Roden, well, these were the best players, not the Hall of Famers. Yeah. Steve Yeager, of course, was a big Steve Yeager guy. He always had awesome pilot. He used to have the cool aviator shades. Ron Say, the Penguin, Garvey, Davey Lopes, Dusty Baker, Rick Monday, and of course the Yankees had all their guys.
like Don Gullett, Ron Guidry, Catfish Hunter, Sparky Lyle, Mike Torres.
Okay, no, what you think.
Bucky.
No.
I had about that. Yeah, everybody, everybody, Reggie overshadows everything that year, but Sparky Lyle was incredible that year.
Yes, he was incredible.
In game five in the Royal Series, a deciding game, Billy Martin brought him in the fourth inning, and he finished the game in relief. He went five and like five and a third of relief. And unfortunately, he paid for his career with that, because that was after that his elbow, he was shot. Yep. Billy really blew him out that year, but Sparky Lyle was tremendous, yep. which kind of gets forgotten. Well, Mr. Hoopla next year they got the goose, sure, and he was but Sparky was done because he gave up his elbow. He gave up his whole career for this yep. year. He was tremendous.
But Sparky Lyle also did one more thing to add to the greatness of a player.
The Bronx Zoo.
Bronx Zoo, and he taught Ron Guidry the slider. And, of course, Ron Guidry would have the kind of year he'd have in 78. We'll get to that in the next episode. By the way, another interesting point. In game – I think it was game two of the World Series. If you remember, as we'll talk about during the news segment after the break, New York City was a fucking toilet in 77. There was a bunch of fire. The Bronx was literally a fucking – it was like used toilet paper. The fucking Bronx is a borough. And – in game two, there was a warehouse on fire because, I mean, Dr. G, literally everything caught fire in the Bronx. And you infamously see out in left field and they show a building on fire. And everybody thinks that Howard Cosell said the Bronx is burning. He never did. Never said it. And, of course, it was the book. And then, of course, ESPN did that kind of pretty cool miniseries. The Bronx is burning about the 77 team. I'm trying to think. Oliver Platt played George. What's his name? Oh, who played Billy Martin? Oh God, what's his name? John Turturro played Billy Martin. Who the hell played Mickey Rivers? I forgot. Oh, Reggie. What's his name? Played Reggie. He was on Rescue Me. I can't think of his name. And then Mickey Rivers is wife.
Daniel Sanjaya.
And then Mickey Rivers, his wife had to take his checks because he kept gambling. He used to go to Aqueduct with him. And then, of course, Oscar Gamble, who Dr. G's dad wanted to beat the shit out of. Anyway, more on that another day. So the Yankees were your world champions in 1977. Very, very impressive. So congratulations to the Bombers. Yay. All right. Let us move on now to the NCAA tournament and the retiring Al McGuire and his Marquette Warriors, when Warriors was not offensive. Defeated North Carolina 67-59. The other Final Four teams, UNLV and UNC Charlotte, the 49ers, was at the Omni in Atlanta. With the number one pick in the 77 NBA draft, the Milwaukee Bucks took Kent Benson, who was a senior. Of course, the previous year, Indiana won the national championship with an undefeated team. With the seventh pick, Mr. D'Amato, the New York Nets took forward Bernard King from the University of Tennessee. Although I like the way Jim Carvalho used to say it, Bernard King, because I love the voice of Jim Carvalho. And, of course, Bernard King would, of course, play for Mr. D'Amato's beloved New York Knickerbockers. Jack Sikma went with the eighth pick from Illinois Wesleyan. Who the fuck would ever be a top 10 pick from that school? But anyway, he was drafted by the Sonics eighth. Your NBA Hall of Fame was Elgin Baylor, Lauren Gale, and William Johnson. The Portland Trailblazers, led by Bill Walton, Maurice Lucas, won the NBA title. They beat the Philadelphia 76ers 4-2. Philly went up 2-0 in that series and then won 4 straight. Of course, George McGinnis got in a big fight with Maurice Lucas. It was Dr. J's first chance at an NBA title after he won 2 ABA titles right in Mr. D'Amato's backyard at the old Nassau Coliseum with the Nets. And this time it fell short. All right. To football. The 1977 Super Bowl, which of course concluded the 1976 season, Super Bowl 11 at the Rose Bowl in Pasadena. The Oakland Raiders defeated the Minnesota Vikings 32-14. And Mr. D'Amato remembers, because he watches NFL film shows like me, one of the greatest moments in the history of Super Bowl 11. Willie Brown intercepting Fran Tarkenton, running it back for a pick six, and the play-by-play guy for the Raiders going, "Oh, man, Willie!" as he runs back the other way. One of the greatest NFL films clips in the history of NFL films. You don't get that anymore. And of
will
course,
it be?
The, will it be?
Will it be? Will it be?
I had Pete Winston on the floor talking about Willie B last night. And of course, the only Super Bowl title for Mr. John Madden. And 0-4 for maybe the greatest head coach to never win a Super Bowl title. That, of course, being the Vikings, Bud Graham. That was the fourth loss for the Vikings. They had lost. And in their defense, I mean, they lost to four powerhouses. They lost to the Chiefs in Super Bowl IV, the Dolphins in Super Bowl VIII, the Steelers in Super Bowl IX, and the Raiders. They didn't lose to, like, scrubs. You know, not that the Vikings didn't have a good team, but they just were not better than any of the teams they faced in the Super Bowl.
Yeah, but they weren't really competitive in any of those games.
I know. Is that crazy?
They were kind of Buffalo-like.
Yeah. Thinkers, all of them. Thinkers, crazy. When you have – I mean, when you got, like, quarterback like Fran Tarkenton, Chuck Foreman as your running back, and, you know, Ahmad Rashad and Sammy White, good receivers. That defense, arguably one of the greatest of all time, and they could never stop anybody on that day. It's amazing. The 1977 NFL draft that April, the number one overall pick was Ricky Bell by the expansion Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Big shock, because the head coach of the Buccaneers was the guy that Ricky Bell's coach was, and that was, of course, John McKay. The number two overall pick via the Seahawks, shrewd trade for the Dallas Cowboys, and they, of course, took your Heisman Trophy winner from the year before, Mr. Tony Dorsett from the University of Pittsburgh. Wesley Walker from the New York Jets went 33rd. Some other well-known picks, Joe Klecko, forgotten Jet. I didn't realize he went to Temple. I thought he was a Southerner. He went to Temple with the 144th pick. This one I'm very proud of because this is one of my favorite guys, and I think this guy sells trucks now.
Cars. He's got a shit ton of dealerships in New Jersey.
With the 219th pick in the 1977 NFL draft, the New York football Giants, the New England Patriots actually, selected Brad Benson from Penn State. So you guys got Brad Benson from the Patriots that built your exemplary offensive line in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. Steve DeBerg was drafted. Yes, John.
Klecko went to Temple because he got a free scholarship. You know, that's big for guys that go to Temple. They like free stuff.
Steve DeBerg started his 15-team career when the Cowboys drafted him with the 275th pick. Rolf Benerska, the future host of Hollywood Squares, I think it was. Or was it Wheel of Fortune? I don't remember. One of the two. Was drafted by the Raiders. Of course, he would end up doing more for the Chargers. And then two undrafted guys that would eventually become head coaches, Tony Dungy and Herman Edwards.
Two you'd top analysis, too.
To play the game. Going into the NFL Hall of Fame that year, Forrest Gregg, Gale Sayers, Bart Starr, and Bill Willis. So there was your – now, the 1977 season – Dallas won the NFC East, Minnesota the Central, the Rams the West, pretty common for the NFC in the 70s, and the Bears won the wild card. Baltimore, Pittsburgh, Denver won the divisions, Oakland won the wild card. Your MVP, Walter Payton, the Bears. Coach of the Year, Red Miller of the Broncos, because they came out of fucking nowhere to win the AFC. And, of course, a myriad of other awards as well. The Seattle Seahawks were in the AFC West. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers were in the NFC Central, and of course the Bucks went 0-14. Believe it or not, the Seahawks actually went. I think they went in 78. I think they went like 2-12 or 3-11, which is pretty epic for an expansion team in the NFL. Instead of a traditional Thanksgiving Day game hosted by the Cowboys, the league scheduled a Dolphins at Cardinals game. This would be only the second time since 1966 that the Cowboys did not play on Thanksgiving, and it would be the last time that the Cowboys would not play on Thanksgiving, because that's stupid. This is the last NFL regular season with 14 games. The season was expanded to 16 games in 78. The preseason was reduced. They played six preseason games. That's fucking ridiculous. Ridiculous.
Four six preseason. Ridiculous.
Ridiculous. The 1977 season is considered the last season dead ball era of professional football. The 17.2 points per game average was the lowest since 1942, and for the 1978 season, the league made significant changes to allow greater offensive production. Some major rule changes. We'll go through these quickly. The head slap is outlawed. Of course, guys, as we all know, who was the maestro of the head slap? A member of the great fearsome foursome of the L.A. Rams, great Hall of Famer Deacon Jones. He was a huge head slapper. Any shoe worn by a player with an artificial limb must have a kicking surface that conforms to that of a normal kicking shoe. That was known as the Tom Dempsey rule. Of course, he was the kicker that had half a foot. He pretty much wore a sledgehammer for a foot, for a cleat, and of course kicked the then record 63-yard field goal. I think it was in 1970. This was the first year of the bump rule, where defenders can only hit the receiver once. After that, it's pass interference. Offensive linemen are not allowed to thrust their hands into a defender's neck. Damn it! Wide receivers are not allowed to clip defenders. And this was the first season when the statistic for time of possession began to be recorded. Interesting. NCAA Division I, Oklahoma was the preseason number one. Notre Dame won the national championship. That was the year, of course, of the Trojan horse game, when Notre Dame came out with their green jerseys in South Bend and beat USC. Earl Campbell won the Heisman. You were talking about the Houston Oilers, Mr. Atherton. Mm-hmm. Guess who the... of course, the Oilers would get considerably better when they would draft Love You Blue, Love You Earl Campbell. The Montreal Canadiens swept the Boston Bruins to win the Stanley Cup. We'll just leave it at that. Two teams would relocate. The Kansas City Scouts moved to Denver to become the Colorado Rockies, and the California Golden Seals moved to Cleveland to become the Barons. The last time a relocation had occurred was when the original Ottawa Senators had relocated in 1934 to become the St. Louis Eagles. Instability and the poor performances of Washington Capitals and the Scouts since the 74 expansion caused the league to shelve an expansion to Denver and Seattle that had been proposed for the season. Of course, in 2 years now, there will be an NHL team in Seattle.
Finally.
The Bruins got swept. What an embarrassment.
I know, really. You know, son of a bitch.
Two nights in a row talking about Bruins losses in the Stanley Cup Finals.
Line judge in that series was a little shaky. Winston knows. Let me call him. We'll be back in about an hour.
No. Well, you know, the Boston Bruins, game that night, it was the same night as a card at the Garden where,
you know, she played just about as good as if, Baron McKelson. I love you, Peter. Tom Watson was your big, money winner that year. He won the Masters and the British Open and won the tour money list. Hubert Green won the U.S. Open and Lanny Watkins won the PGA. We had a Triple Crown winner that year for the first time. Since Secretariat, Seattle Slough won all three races, horse racing. So what do you think, Dr. G? You think Big G won a little scuttle there? What do you think? think the races were on at the bar? What do you think?
I don't know. I don't know how Christmas was that year.
Guillermo Vilas won both of the Grand Slams in tennis. He won the French and the U.S. Open. Bjorn Borg, a Swedish dynamo, won another Wimbledon, and Brazilian star. This is a big deal, guys. Before we wrap up, Brazilian soccer star Pele played his final professional game before retiring on October 1st. Considered by many to be the greatest soccer player of all time, he began his career in the mid 50s. His final game was between Santos, his first professional team, and the team he was playing for at that moment, the New York Cosmos. Pele played for the Cosmos during the first half of the game, and then switched to the other team in the second half. The Cosmos won 2-1. During his career, he helped win three FIFA World Cups for Brazil and has the record of most career goals, 1,281 goals. That's unheard of. That's a ridiculous number. And, of course, the Cosmos used to play at the old Meadowlands. God, imagine playing soccer on that painted pavement. Jeez, that's like playing out in the parking lot. Oof.
That's just falling on a forgotten part of history. The Cosmos were huge this year for like a 3 or 4 year period. The Cosmos, they would be getting like 70,000 to the Giant Stadium. People would be tailgating, and there was a real there was a real craze because they got the Pelé, of course, but he retired this year in 77. But even after, with Giorgio Chinalia, they got guys like from all over the greatest players in the world. Yeah, and your boy Carvalhos was really exciting on the. On the announcer, so yeah, for 3 or 4 years they sold out, you know, like 70,000 plus. It was Cosmo games were a big thing.
Yeah.
Which people find it hard to believe now that soccer only, you know, people only care about it for every few years for the World Cup here in the States. But for those, this is prime, for these, the late 70s, the Cosmos were huge. Mm-hmm. And then there's a great, documentary. There's a great movie about it. It's called, Once in a Lifetime. If you ever check it, it came on ESPN. I don't know if it's on the ESPN Plus or whatever, but it's great. Even if you're not a soccer fan, the documentary is still tremendous, because it also ties into the owner was Ross, Steve Ross, who was president of Warner Records, and yes, who also bought Atari. So it all that stuff kind of ties in, and the Cosmos were like a toy for him, even though they didn't really make money off it. He sunk money into all these players, and he was like he was really into it. So it's great if you guys want to check it out.
Yeah, I saw bits and pieces of Cosmos games all the time, because you guys are appreciated as all you Italians, because the Italian barbers at my dad, I don't know if he still goes there. I don't know if any of them are still cutting hair.
Giorgio Cinali.
But they, we used to go to these guys in Yonkers, these three guys, Victor, Gerard, and Jerry, talking in Italian dialects, drinking espresso, and having soccer on 24/7 while cutting hair. I mean, it's
real. Did they have on Channel 11 Sports? Because if Jerry and Gerard were watching Jerry Gerard. What do you think, Dr. G? Do you think your dad's associates bet on soccer? Right. Yeah. Who's this
fucking he doesn't remember guy. How Christmas That's was so that cute. Year.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Who's Peely? Jeez. Anyway, so that's it for sports in 1977. So big year, of course, Reggie, the Yankees, and more to come from the city of New York for 1977. But let us now go from sports to the boob tube, otherwise known as television, in 1977. Mr. Atherton, the floor is yours.
All right, well, let's dive into TV from 1977. It's about, if you look at the shows and the top rated programs, looked like there was like a shift, that gritty 70s was going kind of out the door, and the lighter fare was starting to take over. So, starting at the top, Happy Days was your number one rated show from 76 to 77, 31.5 rating, followed by Laverne and Shirley, another spinoff, and then the ABC Monday Night Movie, MASH, Charlie's Angels. ABC was having a big year. It looks like four out of the top five were ABC shows, I believe. The Big Event, The $6 Million Man, ABC Sunday Movie, Beretta. Then a bunch of sitcoms and some new ones that we may not have heard of yet. One Day at a Time, Three's Company, All in the Family, Welcome Back, Cotter, Bionic Woman, The Waltons, A Little House on the Prairie, Barney Miller, 60 Minutes, Hawaii Five-O, and so on and so forth. Shows that ended in 77, the McLean Stevenson show. Was that the show that he left for? Or was it for Hello Larry or something that he left?
I thought it was Hello Larry left for, but that had to have been it.
Yeah.
The McLean Stevenson show had to have been it.
All right. Sanford and Son, not that long of a run, but very significant.
Oh, epic. Show. Yep.
Streets of San Francisco, which where the friendship of Danny DeVito and Michael Douglas started, actually. Mm-hmm. The Electric Company, which I think probably went in and out of times. You guys all know what actor guys start on Electric Company, right?
Morgan Freeman.
That's right. Correct.
Rita Moreno started, too.
McMillan and Wife and Emergency. Now, new shows premiered in 77, Circus of the Stars. That was back, we don't see shows like that. And when they do try to bring these kind of concepts back where you see all the different celebrities compete, it just doesn't feel the same, mainly because there's only – back then there were like the three big networks and you had movies. Nowadays there's all these networks, so it's like you haven't heard of most of these people. It's like when I would watch like the Kids' Choice Awards with my kids, and I'm like, who the hell is that? Oh, they're Nickelodeon famous, or they're Disney Channel famous. I have no clue who they are. The Hardy Boys, Nancy Drew Mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a significant show that was on for quite a while. Eight is Enough.
Oh, I love that show.
Which featured a young actor in a pilot, but he did not go on to be on the series because he left because of something else that he had to do that year.
Yes, that's right.
Which we will talk about later. Three's Company. Johnny, you never go down for a drink at the Regal Beagle?
I don't think they would let me in. I wasn't of drinking age, but if I was, I would be right next to Larry Dallas.
That's right.
I'm trying to get some of his shrapnel because Larry Dallas pulled a lot of tail at the Regal Beagle.
That's right.
He would probably be a great wingman.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Are you guys Furley or Ropers?
Mr. Furley all the way, man. When he would get a zinger on his wife Helen, and Mr. Roper, I'm talking. No, yeah. Definitely Mr.
Yeah,
Roper.
Yeah, the Roper. Yeah, I'm Mr. Roper too. Here's the Roper was funny.
When he would get a zinger on Helen, and then he'd give that stupid smile to Moog for the camera. That
break
was,
the fourth
priceless.
Wall. Yep.
Priceless.
Norman Fell had those great facial expressions. Yeah, it was great. Well, what about?
I mean, Mr. Furley was good too. But,
mm-hmm. Yeah, Don Knotts can't go wrong with Don Knotts. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. And then the show obviously went through some changes over the years, and the third or the token blonde roommate changed a few times.
So, yeah, after Suzanne Summers left, the next broad they brought in had the changes in a can size went down a little cup size.
Is it Priscilla Barnes or Jenny Lee Harrison? Which one was that?
Both of them. Nothing better that first couple seasons when Jack would get a good singer and Suzanne Summers would jump up and down and say, "Oh, Jack is so funny," and her bazongas would go boop 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 go up and down. That was nothing. No better TV than that for a young. No lad.
Well, you did get to actually Priscilla Barnes, who went on to be the roommate. You actually see her bazungas in Mallrats. She plays the topless psychic that the that Brody and TS go see. So
that's right.
There's another show we probably all watched growing up. This Week in Baseball. Remember Twib Notes? The Betty White Show also premiered. Another groundbreaking show, Soap, with a very young tremendous. Billy Crystal, amongst others.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent.
Now, I don't remember this premiering in 77, but Inside the NFL?
Oh, yeah. On HBO. I do remember it, yep.
Mm-hmm. It was Bonacardi and
Len Dawson.
And Len Dawson, they were the first.
Nick Boycott, who just passed away last week, I believe.
Yes, he did. Yeah. There's a great documentary on him on HBO right now that Doctor and I watch. It was very good.
Yeah.
Highly recommend it.
And then we have Chips.
I love Chips. Sunday nights on NBC.
Mm-hmm.
Love Chips.
Yeah, everybody, when we were kids, it was always a fight. Like, when you played, games like Dukes of Hazzard or you played Chips, it was always like, who do you want to be, John or Ponch, Which one's cooler? I remember there was
I'm sorry, Andy. Getting back to Soap, it was a groundbreaking show at the time. They'd give like warnings, there would be like sexual contact and adult contact and sexual contact. It was groundbreaking. But Billy Crystal played a gay man who wanted to have a sex change. It was way ahead of his time. A lot of stuff like that. Sexuality and but it also explored a lot of modern things like that wasn't on TV regularly at the time, like interracial romances and stuff like that. It was excellent, along with great comedy. Richard Mulligan, tremendous cast.
I mean, what was that thing he used to do? He used to make himself disappear or be invisible with the finger motion, and it had a dummy too.
Yeah. Yep. Robert Guillaume as Benson, who went on for a successful show. Yeah, the dummy of Chuck and Bob.
Chuck and Bob, that's right. Yeah, that was I think we mentioned this on the last show. Like that was when dummies were big. You had Willie Teller and Lester. Yeah. You had Waylon Flowers and Madam.
And then later on in the 80s, Otto and George was big in the 80s. Yeah, he was fun.
And then we had Operation Petticoat. Came around, and then Lou Grant, which was a unconventional spinoff. I mean, it was a drama that spun off from a comedy, which you never really see.
That's true.
And we had Man from Atlantis, the very young Patrick Ewing. Not Patrick Ewing, I mean Patrick Ewing.
Extremely young Patrick Ewing.
Patrick Duffy, I meant. I don't know why Patrick Ewing.
Wow.
You know why? Because he was on Dallas, and they were the Ewings. And he was Patrick Duffy, get it?
That's right.
All right, so you know, there's a method to my madness. And then The Love Boat, a huge show for a while.
Saturday nights at 9 on ABC.
You know, you can't forget the theme, and then also the cavalcade of guest stars every week, along with the great cast. You know, you had the great, was it Gavin McLeod as Captain Stubing? You had, God, I remember who played Julie. I'm trying to remember now. Lauren Tues.
Lauren Tues.
Tues. The future senator, Fred Grandy, as Gopher. You had Isaac, Mr. Ted Lang. You know, you're a bartender.
And Bernie Coppell. Bernie Coppell is the Studley doctor.
Studley.
He'll play doctor with a lot of ladies in the evening. Doctor by day.
Yes, eventually they added Ted McGinley to their cast, which is every other show did at some point.
The Kiss of, the Kiss of Death.
The patron saint of the Jump the Shark website, by the way. And then there were like some big made-for-TV movies and miniseries that year. We had Jesus of Nazareth, the Incredible Hulk movie.
Which led to the TV show.
I remember this as a kid. The Hobbit, the animated.
Yes. I had the book and record.
I think we watched it in school, actually, I remember.
Mm-hmm.
And then probably one of the biggest miniseries in the history of television, Roots, which was in January of that year.
It was epic. Based on Alex Haley's book, which came out earlier in the decade, and was about his family. And it really, you know, talked about slavery. And what's funny about Roots is, and if you watch the CNN series, The 70s, they talk about that. LeVar Burton mentions this. All of the actors that played like the slave owners were all guys that back in the day were all like good guys, like Robert Reed, you know, Mike Brady, and Lorne Green, who was in Bonanza and he was on Battlestar Galactica, and I forgot who the other one was, Richard Mulligan, and I think somebody else. And they all played these bastard, you know, racist plantation owners that you when you watched Roots, you fucking hated. And it was groundbreaking to see all these actors that we all knew as good guys playing, you know, fucking scumbags. It was crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the cast list now. Wow, I didn't even know, like, you know, Vic Morrow was in it.
He played an asshole in everything.
Yeah.
Smacked his kid around the Bad News Bears, for Christ's sake.
Sandy Duncan was in it.
She was a plantation owner? No, I'm like,
no. Lloyd Bridges?
Yes, he was one. He was a plantation owner. Yep.
I'm trying to think. Let's see. Yeah, Lorne Green, you're in there. Of course, the George Hamilton.
Yeah.
Yeah, the great Scatman Crothers was, of course, in the cast. Who else is here? I didn't know O.J. Simpson was in it. Gary Collins. He's probably one of those. Ian McShane was in it. Probably much very young. Burl Ives. Wow. Tracy Gold.
Yep.
Yeah. Yvonne DiCarlo was in it. Wow. So, yeah, it received, we'll talk about the Emmys in a few minutes, but it received 37 primetime Emmy nominations. It won 9. Unprecedented Nielsen ratings for the finale, which holds the record as the third highest rated episode of any television series. Produced on a budget of $6.6 million. So, it's highly groundbreaking, and, you know, everybody should see it at least once. Saturday morning cartoons, we had the Mumbly Show. Now, Mumbly was the alter ego of Muttley. You always saw him, because I think it was Dick Dastardly and Muttley, and then you had the Red Baron, I think, and Mumbly. I don't know, it was depending on what the universe they were in. Jabberjaw, still around. The Scooby-Doo Dino-Mutt Hour, which I love Dino-Mutt and Blue Falcon, kind of a comedic twist on the superheroes. The Croft Super Show, the Super Friends, the Oddball Couple, Sylvester and Tweety, Clue Club, Bugs and Roadrunner, Tarzan, Lord of the Jungle, The New Adventures of Batman, which is separate from the Super Friends.
Yes, Adam West and Burt Ward actually voiced them. That was the first time they'd come back to the role.
Yes. Shazam, Isis Hour, Fat Albert and the Cosby Kids, Woody Woodpecker, Pink Panther, Speed Buggy, Monster Squad, Space Ghost, Frankenstein Jr., and Land of the Lost. SNL, which we've been talking about now in the third season, some notes about SNL that year. On September 24th of that year, the first appearance of the Festrunk brothers, better known as the Czech brothers, played by Dan Aykroyd and Steve Martin. October 29th of that year, the first appearance of Roseanne Dana. On November 19th, one of the more famous Belushi sketches, almost like a like what they would call, I guess, a digital short these days, the Little Chocolate Donuts.
Mm-hmm.
And then on January 28th, a little later, the first Olympia Cafe sketch, which is the cheeseburger. And the first nerd sketch, which were the couple played by Gilda Radner and Bill Murray.
Yes. Yep.
And then, so run down some of the hosts that year. We had Steve Martin, who I believe hosted the show three times that season.
Yes, he did.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Madeline Kahn, Hugh Hefner, Charles Grodin. Ray Charles hosted and was a musical guest on the same episode. Buck Henry, Mary Kay Place. They did a anyone can host contest, and somebody named Miskel Spillman hosted the show on December 17th.
Might as well do that now. You should do anybody could actually be on the show now. Probably be funnier.
Yeah. Robert Klein, who was, I remember him, he was in that cheeseburger sketch. Yep. Chevy Chase came back to host. OJ Simpson, Art Garfunkel, his ex-partner Paul Simon appeared earlier in the season as a musical guest. Joe Klayberg, Christopher Lee, Michael Palin, mm-hmm. Steve Martin, Richard Dreyfuss, and Buck Henry. The Primetime Emmy Awards that year for shows from the previous season, it was hosted by Angie Dickinson and Robert Blake. Your Outstanding Comedy Series was The Mary Tyler Moore Show. Your Outstanding Drama Series, Upstairs, Downstairs from PBS. Outstanding Comedy Variety or Music Series, Van Dyke and Company on NBC. And as far as your acting categories went, lead actor in a comedy was Carol O'Connor for All in the Family. Actress in a comedy series was Bea Arthur from Maude. And then over on the drama side, you had James Garner for The Rockford Files and Lindsay Wagner from The Bionic Woman. And then supporting actor, we had comedy. We had Gary Berghoff. Supporting actress in the comedy series was Mary Kay Place from Mary Hartman. Supporting actor in a drama series was Gary Frank from Family. And also from Family, a supporting actress in a drama series was Christy McNichol. You guys have a crush on Christy McNichol growing up?
Not really.
No, sir.
I didn't. She didn't do much for me.
Well, she's all right. She was okay, but then when she was on Empty Nest, come on, she was kind of hachi-machi on Empty Nest.
mm-hmm.
No?
Actually, yeah. I like Dinah Manoff better, actually.
Oh, who was the only person that was actually a teenager when they did Grease. Also, let's see what happened that year. There was some controversy. We had Esther Rawl departed the CBS sitcom Good Time shortly after the conclusion of a two-part four-season finale, Love Has a Spot on Its Lung, due to the dismissal of John Amos, who they killed off in that episode, I'm guessing, and the stereotypical behavior of his de facto star, Jimmy Walker, who portrayed her son, J.J. Mm-hmm. Evans. She did not return until the sixth and final season in September of 1978. And then, I remember this I think this was on the Bob Barker bio. A tube top clad woman on September 17th named Yolanda Bosley is called into contestants' row on the CBS game show The Price is Right.
Yes, I remember.
While
this.
Running down, her breasts pop out of her shirt. The incident was censored with a large blue bar, but is still remembered today. And then back to Good Times, 11-year-old Janet Jackson joined the cast for the final two seasons as Penny Gordon. And then talking about a new Peanuts special premiered that year on October 24th. It's Your First Kiss, Charlie Brown, on CBS. It shows and names Heather, the little red-haired girl, thereupon ending the mystery of Charlie Brown's crush. Billy Crystal, we mentioned earlier, on December 2nd, sets a winner's circle record by getting a contestant to the top of the pyramid in 26 seconds on ABC's The $20,000 Pyramid. The record still stands today. And that is our television. You guys got memories of some of the SNL characters from that time?
Oh, yes. Bill Murray also made his debut that year.
Yes.
I'm not too big on rankings, but it might go down as, if not the, well, definitely one of the top years as far as debuted in The Wild and Crazy Guys and the Cheeseburger and mm-hmm. Little Chocolate Donuts. This was Brian Belushi. Also, Steve Martin was becoming iconic with all his guest spots, and also his comedy was he was selling out arenas with his stand up, and he would I think it won't be till 78 when he drops King Tut, which was we'll talk about it next step. But just an epic year for SNL overall, 77.
Yeah, I think the Lounge Singer, I don't know if he made his debut that year, but he did the famous Star Wars, you know.
Bill Murray, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Awesome. That's going to round out television in 1977. So we're going to take a break, come back, talk about Police Nation for a minute, and also go into the news, music, and sports of that great year. So, with Scott Criscolo, Dr. G, George Rubolino, and Jarrison D'Amato, I'm Andy Acton. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Police Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PoliceNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Police Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content, offering tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these current shows, plus archives of our previous podcasts over the past 8 years as well, by subscribing to our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others available at PlaceNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceNation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping. And be sure to join us at our forum at Bigelow34.proboards.com. For all sorts of wrestling, sports, and pop culture discussion each and every day, where you can make your voice heard. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Nation, welcome back to the year in pop, 1977, and boy, we've already loaded up on epic moments and more to come. Scott Criscolo, Andy Atherton, J. Arsenio D'Amato, and the doctor, Dr. G, George Rubolino. I mean, we've already talked about the Yankees, we've talked about great TV, and we've talked about NFL, and we still got so much more to discuss. Big things went on in the city of New York in 1977, good and bad. So why don't we eschew some of the big stuff and just mention the two great feeds at PlaceNation.com. Of course, the PlaceNation pop feed with all of your great stuff, including this show, as well as Mr. D'Amato's show with the Cowboy Roger Moore set this week in the NFL. Johnny coming back soon, right, as the season's around the corner?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Oh. 2 weeks. 2 weeks. We're gonna drop the preview. No, I was just getting. I was just looking at the calendar, getting the dates. Right before the season starts. What is the fifth? Look forward. Look forward about the third or fourth. Our big season preview.
Excellent, excellent. And of course, we did a great looking forward, looking back, which is on the pop feed right now. Check out also the continuing great things for Pop Goes the Movies, where we do a bunch of movie reviews of all this stuff all summer. And, of course, we'll be doing the summer recap show soon, Mr. Atherton, and then preview the fall and how Episode 9 will break Endgame's record. and we'll talk more about that. And also other great stuff on the pop feed as well. Of course, the great comic stuff. And, of course, over to the wrestling feed Place to Be podcast. Of course, a new episode of Place to Be Nation's main event will drop later in the week. So yeah, check out all the great stuff on both the Place to Be Nation pop feed and the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed. Continue checking out the 80s greatest song of the 80s contest continues. We're in the second round still, almost wrapping it up. The matchups, Mr. Atherton, have been tougher and tougher as the days have progressed. Yes. We had a few nail biters today and more to come. So keep checking out the Facebook page and get your vote in. Also check it out on Twitter as well.
Yeah, Twitter's making a difference in some of these.
Yes.
Some of these contests. So,
yep.
Yeah, I mean that. Yeah, it got. I think who was it? Got a groundswell. I think Duran mm-hmm. Came back to beat Tom Petty. We had two Duran and Tom Petty matchups.
It was like a Hogan Andre blood feud between Duran and Tom Petty in this tournament.
It was like Booker T and Chris Benoit over the TV title.
Just a set, exactly. Yep.
Awesome.
So check it out. Mm-hmm. Check it out.
All right. Cool.
Now, let us continue on with the Epic Year 1977 and get into what was going on in the world, news and such. So with that, I hand it back off to my co-host, Mr. Atherton.
All right. Thank you very much. So lots went on that year. A lot of stuff local. There was some big news. We'll get to that in a second. But overseas, you know, we had Egyptian President Anwar Sadat made a historic trip to Israel in November. It was the first step towards establishing a long-term peace agreement between Egypt and Israel. The U.S. returns to the Panama Canal back to Panama following negotiations. A treaty is signed, which begins the process of granting Panamanians free control of the canal so long as Panama signed a treaty guaranteeing the permanent neutrality of it. Prime Minister Indira Gandhi resigns from office in 1977. She was the daughter of, had been involved in politics most of her life. She had consolidated her power after being accused of corruption and faced unrest from the opposition. After she resigned, she was expelled from the parliament, was soon reelected in 1980, becoming prime minister again until her death. The transatlantic oil pipeline opened on May 31st of that year. During February, the Soviet Union launched the Soyuz 24 space mission. President Carter granted pardons to American draft dodgers during the Vietnam War period. The Medal of Freedom was awarded posthumously to the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Roman Polanski is arrested and charged with a number of offenses, including rape by use of drugs, perversion, sodomy, lewd, and lascivious acts upon a child. Yeah, upstanding guy right there. And then we had something big here in the New York area. We had the great New York City blackout that lasted 25 hours. George, do you have memories of the blackout?
I do. It's one of those. I remember it happening. I was living in Brooklyn at the time, and my dad. Everybody hung out on their stoops. You know, like it became like a big block party. You know, give people from Brooklyn a chance to party. You know, they'll find a way to make a party at any situation. But I remember my dad going, because you know he wanted to find out what was going on. So he got all of us in his car. I'll never forget it. He had like Cadillac at the time. We all got in the car, me, my mom, my sister was a baby, and I remember driving on the Bell Parkway and everything was just dark. You know, like we usually see the bridges lit up, everything. I just remember everything being just pitch black. And I just remember driving around. He just wanted to see what was going on, but I know that there was a lot of looting and stuff that went on. The neighborhood we were at, we were living in Bensonhurst, so it was pretty much okay. Everybody was just kind of like making a party out of it. And I remember just coming back and everybody just being out on their stoops, bringing food out, bringing out whatever, beer and, you know, liquor and all that kind of stuff. And everybody just making a party out of it, you know, like nobody getting like too stressed about it. You know, everybody had their transistor radios at the time, trying to find out what was going on. And I know we have like a, you know, there's like a breakdown of like everything that went on during that time, which obviously that brings back a lot of memories. But that's just one of the few things I remember at that age, just because I remember the big partying and then my dad wanting to go drive around and find out what the heck was going on. And my mom like yelling at him, like, why are we driving around in this? We're going to get killed. that's basically my memory of it.
All right. Johnny, did that affect you guys in Long Island at all or no?
Nah, Lilco kept us strong. Mm-hmm. But, just watching on the news, all the looting was crazy. It just gave people gave people a chance to get that TV that they couldn't afford. And
go ahead, Don.
All the looters, and unfortunately, it was a rough time to be a New York City police officer. A lot of cops got injured, and watching all the chaos on the news, it was crazy.
Yeah. So just quickly, the timeline. So about 8:37 p.m., a lightning strike struck at Buchanan South, a substation on the Hudson River, tripped two circuit breakers in Westchester County. 5 minutes later, a second lightning strike caused the loss of two transmission lines, loss of power from nuclear plant at Indian Point, and Con Ed attempted to start fast start generators. No one was manning the station, and a remote start failed. A third lightning strike took out two additional critical transmission lines at Springbrook. Wow, that's not far from where I was living at the time, in Yonkers. Con Ed operators later on initiated first 5% system-wide voltage reduction, then 8% reduction, basically, cutting the power in some spots to try to, get it on, sooner. First, 9:19 p.m., the first final major interconnection to upstate New York at Leeds substation tripped to thermal overload. And then so on and so forth. The biggest generator at 9:27 at night, biggest generator in New York City, Ravenswood 3, also known as Big Alias, shut down, ending power to New York City. At 9:29, the Gothel's Linden interconnection with New Jersey tripped. So basically, they started safeguarding and trying to cut power here and there just to get everything back on. At 9:36 that night, so about roughly 59 minutes later, the entire Con Ed power system shut down. During the blackout, LaGuardia and Kennedy were both closed for 8 hours. Most of the television stations in New York City were off the air. About 4,000 people had to be evacuated from the subway system, like Johnny and George alluded to. Widespread looting, vandalism, and arson in every poor neighborhood of the city. Approximately 1,616 stores were damaged due in the looting and rioting. 550 police officers injured during the civil disorder and 4,500 looters arrested. At about 10:39 p.m. the next day, about 24 hours later, power is finally fully restored, and everybody, I guess, was happy. And that also leads us into another big part of the news, which started in 76 but came to its conclusion in 77, was the arrest in Yonkers of David Berkowitz, a.k.a. the Son of Sam. George, being, you remember this pretty vividly as well.
I do remember this a little bit. I remember my dad had to go away or something for a trip or something. And I remember him having, my uncles or uncles to come over and be – we had a dog at the time. So, to walk my dog, and he was targeting – a lot of times he's targeting younger women or whatever. So making sure that somebody was with my mom all the time when she had to walk the dog I just remember women especially being very, very scared. I remember if somebody came to the door, knocking at our door or whatever, my mom looking through the peephole, make sure that, just everybody was a little on edge at that time. Based on that, that's just a little bit that I remember, but I do remember, somebody always being like my uncles coming over if my mom had to walk my dog or whatever. Everybody lived in the same neighborhood at that time, so everybody was able to look out for each other. But it was kind of a scary time, when I think about it. I kind of remember I was 3 or 4 years old, but just the little things like that come back to you. I can't remember too much more than just those, these few memories, big memories at that time. But, I just remember everybody being very, very happy when they arrested him. Mm-hmm. Took a lot of people off edge, let me tell you.
Yeah. Johnny, remember what was going on back then?
Yeah, it was wild how one sick man could put fear into a whole city, as women. It turned out most of the victims were like blondes, so so women would wear wigs of a different color. You know, if women had natural blonde hair, they would they would wear wigs to avoid this and just to put the whole city in a craze. One sick person. It was and just following the police investigation. Just a fascinating time.
Mm-hmm. Scott, you grew up. You were kind of like on the periphery. What was going on? What was it like up here in Connecticut? Kind of like far.
Yeah, I mean, it was. I mean, we had a lot of our own share of mystery murders around where I grew up earlier in the decade. And my mom, you know, I remember my dad talking about this all the time. There was the Penny Sarah murder. She was a woman that worked in an office building on Temple Street in New Haven. And in 1975, I think, or 74, she was found dead in the stairwell of the Temple Street garage, which is across the street from the old New Haven Coliseum. And I, to this day, it's still unsolved. I mean, they think it's there are a couple of suspects, but obviously statute of limitations has passed. But and then there was the murder of a hooker. Had to have been New Haven. I don't know. Maybe it was Bridgeport. Who knows? But she was found dead behind the Bradleys off the highway in East Haven. So we had our own share of like mysteries. But I mean, I used to remember kind of watching because my dad, my dad used to have picks. We used to leave the news on after the Yankee game. So we used to leave Channel 11 on and have the news on. So I kind of remember like, you know, Steve Bosch and, you know, those guys, Chuck Scarborough and all those guys. Talking about it and leading the news with it. So it was definitely like mysterious for us, you know, being up here in the burbs. I do remember the blackout, though, because I remember my dad telling me, my God, thank God we're not there, because, you know, blackouts seem to be more prevalent back in the day because electric systems, even here in Connecticut, were not as sturdy as they are today. So we used to get them a decent amount even up here. What's funny about historically about the Son of Sam killings is that they were a year old. The first one was Christmas Eve of 1975. He attempted to stab somebody in the Bronx. No, in Yonkers, actually. So right in your backyard there, Mr. Atherton. Mm-hmm. You could have seen out your window when you were playing with your Millennium – well, no, it wouldn't have been that. So there's no Millennium Falcon. Well, there was, but not the toy. The first actual deaths occurred July 29th, 1976 in the Bronx in Pelham. He shot two teenagers sitting outside Oldsmobile at Peachtree's, a New Rochelle discotheque. Ooh, back when Iona was cool. And then he moved on to October 76 in Flushing. I think the thing that fascinated me the most was he went all over the place. He was killing women in the Bronx. He was killing people in Queens. He was killing people in Brooklyn. He was all over the fucking boroughs. I'm surprised he didn't go out to Long Island. It seemed like he was going everywhere. He obviously didn't go to Staten Island, and obviously he really couldn't kill anybody in Manhattan because, well, considering that the city was fiscally a toilet and there was practically no fucking cops anyway, which is probably why the cops got attacked during the blackout because the unions were shutting them down. What a shock, G. Unions causing problems in Manhattan. Well, wonders never cease. So that was the thing, is just how fascinating this guy just got around. And it was a parking ticket that did him in.
Yeah.
Isn't that bonkers? He had his car parked illegally in Brooklyn when he attacked the two most famous victims. I got to find their names. Stacy Moskowitz and Robert Violante. That was Bath Beach. Dr. G knows where that is. And
Yeah.
So Detective John Filatico was awakened at home and told to report to the 10th Homicide Division of the 60th Precinct Station House in Coney Island. There you go. He was given 2 weeks to work on the Moskowitz and Violante case as a normal murder investigation. If it could not be solved in that time frame, it was to be given to the Son of Sam task force. And eventually he was arrested in Yonkers. So look at all of this, guys. So what a year 1977 was in New York City. Another thing that we can't forget is that it was also a mayoral race. A Beam was not going to win because he was, you know, he pretty much ran the city into the fucking ground. And it was down to Mario Cuomo, the hell was that woman's name? Oh, shit. The fuck was her name? She was like the first woman running for mayor in New York City. I don't remember her name. And of course, the guy who eventually won, obviously one of the more memorable mayors in city history, Ed Koch. So it was a crazy year in New York City. Bunch of stuff going on. But that's what always fascinated me about the Son of Sam was that he did it everywhere. I mean, he went all over the fucking boroughs, just whacking people left and right. It was nuts. I can't believe he's still alive. I figure somebody would have shanked him by now.
Yeah, the woman's name was Bella Abuz.
Bella Abzu. Bella Abzu. She was you know, one of these typical, you know, old school Democrat activist chicks. And she you know, she thought she could change the city, blah, blah, blah. And yeah, she lost to it was a three candidate race. Her, Mario Cuomo, and Ed Koch, and Ed Koch won. Mm-hmm. So anyway.
I love Sunday in New York, one of my favorite when Claymation was becoming big. It's Ed Koch, Claymation Ed Koch singing, yes. It's Up to You, New York, New York.
Yep.
Great,
by the way, there's a great movie that came out in 1999 called Summer of Sam. I highly recommend it. I don't know if anybody's seen it. I think, Johnny, have you and I ever talked about it? I think we have. Tremendous movie, Summer of Sam, about that summer, the blackout, the Yankees, whole bunch of stuff. So check it out. Good movie.
Yeah.
Came out in 1999.
Yeah, Spike
John Lee. Yep, Spike Lee, John Leguizamo was in it. It's pretty good. Gee, you'll have to find it. You'll have to watch it. I don't know if I've ever watched it with you. Good movie, Summer of Sam.
Yeah, I think Adrian Brody was like the star, wasn't he?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right, well, that's going to do it with the news. And Scott, what's going on in the world of music in 77?
Well, not much. No, I'm kidding. here are the top 10 songs that ended 1977. At number 10, these are the singles on the Billboard chart. Number 10, Torn Between Two Lovers by Mary McGregor. Number 9, a yacht rock classic, Undercover Angel by Alan O'Day. Number 8, Your Love Has Lifted Me Higher and Higher by Rita Coolidge. Don't Leave Me This Way by Thelma Houston, as we were slowly getting a taste of disco, but not quite yet. I Like Dreamin' by Kenny Nolan, One Hit Wonder at number 6. Number 5, Angel in Your Arms by Hot. Number 4, Evergreen, love theme from the 90th remake of A Star is Born, as this past one was the 91st, Barbra Streisand. Best of My Love by The Emotions. Number 2, I Just Want to Be Your Everything by Andy Gibb. And the number 1 song in the country, Tonight's the Night by Rod Stewart. One of the greatest double entendre lyrics of all time, Spread Your Wings and Let Me Come Inside. Other songs on the list that were very well known, Dancing Queen by ABBA. A song you mentioned earlier, Andy, off air, Margaritaville by Jimmy Buffett. Telephone Line by ELO is a great song. We got a bunch of great albums that came out in 77. We'll get to that in a minute. But one of the singles, Hotel California by the Eagles. Gonna Fly Now, of course, the theme to Rocky, even though the movie came out in 76. Rich Girl by Hall & Oates was one of their first big hits. Car Wash, Rose Royce. What are the good ones? Don't Give Up on Us by Starsky and Hutch star David Soul. I had his 45. I had the 45 of that. Great song. Feels Like the First Time by Foreigner. That was their debut album that year. Easy by the Commodores, Like Sunday Morning. And a bunch of other great, great songs. So, in terms of albums, My. Look at the albums that came out in 1977. At number 25, here's 25 of them off the top of my head. Number 25, Let There Be Rock by AC/DC. That was a live album, actually. It was exceptional. Number 24, Heart of the Congos by the Congos. Number 23, News of the World by Queen. Tremendous album. A good follow-up to Night at the Opera, which, of course, had a Bohemian Rhapsody on it. Number 22, A Farewell to Kings by Rush. Number 21, Before and After Science by Brian Eno. Number 20, The Idiot by Iggy Pop. 19, Suicide by Suicide. Number 18, Out of the Blue by ELO. Number 17, Rocket to Russia by the Ramones. Lust for Life by Iggy Pop. So two albums by Iggy in 77. Number 15, Talking Heads 77 by Talking Heads. At number 14, arguably one of the greatest albums of all time, one of the greatest album covers of all time, and I know for a fact, Dr. G, you had the tape because we used to play it in the office
in our newspaper office. And D'Amato, I know you had a copy as well. And my brother had the album. It was one of the first albums I ever listened to. Bat Out of Hell by Meatloaf.
Yes.
What a tremendous album. Tremendous fucking album.
I like that album.
Tremendous. Number 13, My Aim Is True by Elvis Costello. Number 12, Wire with Pink Flag. We're going to skip number 11 for the moment. We'll get to that in a minute. Number 10, The Trans-Europa Express by Kraftwerk, a very well-known German band. Number 9, Exodus by Bob Marley and the Wailers. Number 8, Heroes by David Bowie, as he was in his Great White Duke phase. Mr. D'Amato and I are going to see a facsimile of David Bowie in the coming weeks. Number 7, Asia by Steely Dan, tremendous album. Number 6, The Clash's debut album. Number 5, Nevermind the Bullocks, Here Come the Sex Pistols by the Sex Pistols, as of course punk started to make its way into the mainstream. Mm-hmm. Number 4, Low by David Bowie, another part of the Berlin trilogy. Number 3, Marquee Moon by Television, again, continuing of punk and new wave getting into the mainstream. Number 2, Animals by Pink Floyd. And let's talk about this album real quick before we talk about the other one. Hotel California, which I think technically came out in 76, but we'll talk about it in 77. Hotel California was a tremendous album with tremendous singles. But when you think of 1977, besides the other album that we're going to mention in a minute, you think of – and this is probably a top five album of all time, and that is Rumors by Fleetwood Mac. I mean, honestly, guys, there's probably not one bad song on the album.
It's a good album.
It's absolutely tremendous. Remember, they made it. Now, everyone thinks that their, quote, debut album was the one that came out a couple years earlier that had Rhiannon on it. But people forget that, you know, Fleetwood Mac was back in the 60s. They were a British blues band in the late 60s, led by Peter Green and Mick Fleetwood and John McVie. Christine McVie joined in, I think, 70. But it wasn't until 74 when, of course, the last two big pieces of the puzzle joined the band, that, of course, being Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham. Then that album came out that had Rhiannon on it, and then of course 1977 Rumors. Of course, the drama on that during the making of that album is off the charts. You know, Lindsey and Stevie were having relationship problems. John McVie was a drunk, and Christine McVie hated him. And then Stevie was getting it thrown into her by Mick Fleetwood at some point during the making of the album. And I mean, there was all sorts of fucking sex drama going on behind the scenes. But they go to the Sausalito studio every day and put together arguably the greatest album of all time. Johnny, what's your thoughts on Rumors?
It's one of the albums where you can, instead of just picking and choosing different songs, you just play it. You just play it from start to finish. And it's one banger after another. Don't Stop, Go Your Own Way, The Chain, Gold Dust Woman, there were five or six iconic songs.
Gee, was this album in your cassette rotation on the train?
It's one of my favorite albums. I definitely like it. I do have it on my Apple Music. So,
Gold Dust Woman was actually one of my favorite cuts.
77 really.
Yeah,
was,
me too.
I mean, it was a great year for music. I mean,
it was.
We were young then, but we've had more appreciation as we gotten older, but.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you had mentioned the Queen. Queen,
really a great year.
Yep. Queen, News of the World. They dropped "We Will Rock You" and "We Are the Champions." They kind of dropped them like back to back.
Yep.
Like I remember when they both. It was like both of them boom on the radio at the same time, and you know, forever.
Yep.
Yeah. Speaking of "Bat Out of Hell," "Paradise" by a Dashboard Light came on 70s on 70 the other day. In the car with I was with my son.
Nice.
Trying to,
one of the greatest wedding reception songs of all time.
Trying to explain to him kind of like I don't know if he's going to ask.
Has he got the first base yet? Or
he's 12, but
if he hung out with the rest of the idiots long enough, he might have.
Yeah. I remember I went to Catholic all boys high school. I remember what was it, freshman or sophomore year? They made us listen to Paradise by the Dashboard Lights, and then we had to talk about what our interpretation was of it.
Oh boy!
School of
that's not opening any doors there. Wow.
What do you boys think this song's about? I think somebody said, "Brother, it's about getting laid."
I know.
It's Phil Rizzuto to announce a baseball game.
Set you up? They were definitely trying to set you up. That was a scam job right there, those brothers. Trust me, I went to all boys Catholic school, high school too, and I know I know what it's like to get set up by those guys. Arguably one of the greatest wedding reception songs of all time, mm-hmm. as Dr. G can back me up on.
And on the video, you know, that poor girl had to make out with meatloaf. I mean, she had to act it out while that poor,
it's,
you know.
It was actually like sticking your tongue in a meatloaf.
I actually got to meet meatloaf about, it was 2011. I was at an event for the Celebrity Apprentice. So as we were leaving, we met meatloaf, Marlee Matlin, who is beautiful. Oh my God, in person. Star Jones was a bitch. just went by. John Rich from Big and Rich, who won that season, was a real good guy. I just missed shaking hands with our current president now, as I was in the bathroom because they gave us Trump water to drink and I had to pee right afterwards. So he was going around shaking people's hands as I was in the can. I could hear him outside, and I don't know if it was a good thing or a bad thing. But yeah, Meatloaf seemed like a very nice guy, though, when I met him. I talked to him about Gene Simmons' appearance on the Celebrity Apprentice earlier in the night.
But yeah, that ought to hell a tremendous album, of course, as well as Rumors. But we will save arguably the best for last. to this point in this gentleman's career, and by the way, he was also, and we'll get to the musical guests in a second of Saturday Night Live, because this guy was one of them, as was Meatloaf, actually. As a matter of fact, that was the following year, 78. Going into 1977, this artist had some moderately decent albums. He had just come off of Turnstiles, which was a solid album, but arguably not great. It was good. And then he made one huge decision that would change his life and the life of all of us as music fans forever. And that was the hiring of Phil Ramone as producer. Of course, Phil Ramone was at the time known for working with, I think, Carole King, I think, right? Or Carly Simon and Paul Simon, Simons. So
he worked with Frank Sinatra as well.
And Sinatra. Of course, we were talking about the great William Martin Joel. And in 1977, The Stranger came out. And I think we could safely say that it was truly, I mean, we knew the song that put him on the map, but this was the album that put him on the map. The Stranger, of course, has Just the Way You Are, which is the Doctor's wedding song. Only the Good Die Young. Of course, maybe Dr. G's in my favorite song of all time, Scenes from an Italian Restaurant. And Get It Right the First Time, good album cut. Vienna, right? Yeah, Vienna.
Yep.
Song about his dad leaving them, the family. What was it, Johnny? I'll ask you first, and then I'll pull the ripcord on the doctor. What was it about this album that was different than his others? Like, why was this album the one that did it, you think?
That's a tough one. I guess it was something about moving out that it was just a different that song kind of moved him into the stratosphere of a big pop star. It was just something about that song that separated from what he had put out previously.
Mm.
There you go.
All right, Doctor. Floor is yours. What was it about this album that Phil Ramone helped make that made this one different than the others?
Well, you know, his first few albums, I mean, you know, it was that, you know, singer-songwriter kind of thing, you know, early 70s. I think I agree with John about this song moving out. It was just, it kind of, you know, that's when pop, the pop music was starting to kind of, you know, the charts started being filled with you know, pop songs. So it kind of had that, you know, the singer-songwriter, but just a little bit more, I'm trying to think of the word, like more, not edge, because it wasn't an edgy song, but
more mainstream, I guess, is that probably the better word for it? And just the way you are, what was it, Linda Ronstadt, I think, was the one convinced him when he was, and Phoebe Snow, I think they were recording in the same place that he was, and he was trying to pick out his songs, and they told him to keep, you know, you should keep that song on the album. He didn't even really care for the song, and that wound up being his biggest hit on the whole, on the whole album. Mm-hmm. And a lot of songs on that album, yes, for that year, obviously put him into a different stratosphere. But over the years, like songs like Scenes from the Italian Restaurant, because it was a long song. You remember in those days, they kept song between 3 and 4 minutes, mostly were the hits. And that song became more after him doing it in concert. It kind of was like song that became more popular after the fact kind of thing. I mean, I don't think he's done a show without it since the album came out. I think he's every concert he's pretty much played since probably 77, 78.
I agree.
He's played that song all the time. He said he can't go without playing that song.
No,
he could probably get away without playing Piano Man before he could get away without playing that song. In my view, what do you think, John? Do you think you agree?
Yeah, definitely. The Scenes has become the song that has to be played. Sure.
I mean, to me, I love that song because I love the way it was written, the different pieces of it, and to me, it is my favorite song of all time, hands down. I mean, somebody asked me, you know, what my favorite song is of all time, or even asked me what my favorite Billy Joel song. It's definitely that. And we have a lot of memories of it because we started a tradition at friend's wedding, one of our friends' weddings, and then we just continued it at every wedding of all our friends. We always yep. sing that song.
Yep. Well, we started singing it at the bar in what, 93? So I think we got a good 8 years of practice by the time we got to yours. So
exactly. So now it comes out of every song, but it's. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely the album that took him. Now, some will say, and I think it's kind of thing you said. You say that his next album, 52nd Street, is even better.
I think so.
Overall album.
I think so. We'll get more into that in 78. But yeah. You know what I think it is, G? And I agree, guys, if I'm talking with three New Yorkers. The thing I think I love the most about 52nd, The Stranger, and I say this, I'll say the same thing when we do the 1978 show about 52nd Street. They just feel New York. Yeah. Like the other albums have that poppy kind of, you know, remember Billy lived in LA for a while, and obviously that's how Piano Man came from, etc. But I think Phil Ramone added that New York feel to The Stranger.
Little Edge, the band.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, he started playing with his band that he played with on stage rather than a session
guys. Exactly. I mean, he played with Liberty and Russell Javers and Richie Cannata, and he was playing with his boys, and I think that, and we've all seen them, guys. We've seen all pieces of that band today, either Big Shot or Lords of 52nd Street. Those guys are New York, you know, except the one guy from Jersey, or is that Doug Stegmeier? I don't know. One of them's from Jersey, but they're all New Yorkers. They all either grew up in D'Amato's backyard or they grew up in somebody else's borough, and they. We're New York, and I think that's why The Stranger is such a tremendous album for people. A lot of people just don't get it. Like, Billy is a very – kind of like Bruce. Billy is a very regional – I mean, he's loved all around the world. Don't get me wrong. I understand that. But the diehards get it because of where they're from. Like, I feel like New Englanders, I don't think they get it like New Yorkers get it, or even people from Connecticut, from this part of Connecticut, don't get it. Like people that are from Jersey don't get the Bruce thing. You know what I'm saying? And Billy, I think, is a lot like that.
It's amazing to me, though, that when you see them, and I'm still touring at this age, that, you know, because we know what the music means to us because we're in this area. But it's weird to think that, yeah, he could go to Boston and play New York State of Mind and people will sing along with it. You know, or, you know, go to another part of the country and play those New York songs and people go crazy for them.
Yep.
And so it is interesting, you know, how
And same thing with Bruce, you know, with the Jersey-centric songs. And maybe people like that never, maybe, I mean, they haven't been to this area. They're kind of like fascinated by it, by hearing the music. And it makes them want to visit this area. I don't know. I don't, you know, because I can't answer to that. Because I, this is where I was, you know, this is where I was born. So I get it. But yeah, no, you're right. I definitely think they have the New York edge.
Just like our rumors at this time, this was prime time for albums. You had to come up with a whole album of like nine songs to play from start to finish. There were different type of parties. There were parties where people would play like singles and dance music, and there were album parties where you would just drop the needle on the album, and then of course flip it.
Yep.
But and play the whole album from start to finish, and just like Rumors, this is one of the he was one of the few artists that could pull that off.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree 100%. So we will continue our Billy Joel trek, because over the next few episodes of Year in Pop, we will be getting more fantastic top to bottom. I can't wait till the next episode when we talk about 52nd Street. But The Stranger came out in 1977, and that set the tone. Quickly, let me run through the musical guests on Saturday Night Live. Andy mentioned the hosts. Jackson Browne, Taj Mahal, Libby Titus, Paul Simon, speaking of, you mentioned Ray Charles, Leon Redbone, Willie Nelson, Elvis Costello, Randy Newman, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, Bonnie Raitt. Speaking of Billy, he was on the February 18th, 78 episode. Ashford and Simpson, Stephen Bishop, Eddie Money, Meatloaf was on March 25th. Eugene Record, Keith Jarrett, the Blues Brothers, Jimmy Buffett sang Margaritaville, and then the season ended with Sun Ra. And then finally, before we wrap it up and head to wrap it up with the movies, we talked about it on the when Andy was going over deaths. We're going to have to talk about it because we lost arguably one of the most seminal artists in the history of music on August 18th, 1977. The King died from on his throne. And that was, of course, Elvis Presley, died at the age of 42 of an apparent heart attack from all of his years of two and all, second alls, and gravy sandwiches at Graceland. He was the king, guys. He was the king of rock. First guy to shake his ass, first guy to move his hips on TV. They had to shoot, he was on American Bandstand or he was on TV shows. They had to shoot him from unprecedented censorship they had to do back in the day. They had to cut off his crotch because he was waving it at the camera lens. And I mean, he gave music that sexy side that hadn't happened yet in music in the 50s. Then he went in the Army, came back, did, Beach Blanket Bingo or any of those fucking shitty beach movies he did. Then he did that epic, then he was kind of out of the limelight for a while in the 60s. And then he came back with that epic Hawaii concert special in 67 or 68. And then was back on top, and he did shows. He played the New Haven Coliseum. He played the Garden. He was good friends with Richard Nixon. He was actually an honorary ATF agent, carried a fuck ton of firearms. Imagine getting busted in a meth lab by the King wearing his secret outfit. That'd be fucking great. But again, he did not take care of his, body in the end. He was very reclusive. And he died of a heart attack from continuous years of pill abuse at the age of 42. I have to admit, my parents were not Elvis fans, I didn't have a ton of Elvis in my house. What about you, G?
No,
your dad didn't like Elvis.
No, my parents weren't into Elvis as well. I don't really know a family member that was a big Elvis fan.
What about you, Andy?
Yeah, we had Elvis fans in the family. Growing up about this time, my father did have some Elvis albums. I mean, it was mostly, in the car, in the backseat, I can hear Neil Diamond, Kenny Rogers, Linda Ronstadt. That was the kind of stuff. And Cousin Brucey, of course, on the radio. But, yeah, we had a few Elvis albums. My grandmother was huge in Elvis, and she lived with us for a while. Not in 77, but a little later on. But, yeah, she
– right.
Yeah, it was he was a big deal. I mean, the king – he was the king. And it was, it's a familiar story with a lot of these incredible talents, have all this money and all this fame, but, it's just, they just can't handle it. It's not enough, or they just, get addicted to something, and they their lives end tragically and way too early.
Yep. Yep. What about you, Johnny? Well,
go ahead. No, I'm saying some people, fame, you figure the guy that's why he was reclusive. He couldn't go to the movies. He couldn't go, just like it was very hard, and he had a hard time dealing with that because, he couldn't be a normal person at times, which is what a lot of people that are famous want. We think we would want to be famous, but it would probably suck if we couldn't just go to the store when we want to, or, he just never was able to have his own downtime, so he kind of medicated himself to get through that.
Mm. Johnny, was your family big Elvis fans?
Not at all, and especially at this time, it was all dominated by the 70s music, right. A lot of what we talked about. But he was more of a iconic figure as far as the movies and stuff. But what's interesting is he was touring at this time, and there was still. Some people still have concerts for tickets that was coming out. I think one was in the Westbury Music Fair here on Long Island. He was
really?
I think he dropped a couple of days before he was supposed to play there. So, yeah, he was still touring at his old Elvis. And it was hard to believe. It was a reminder that he went so soon at 42.
Yeah.
That he was still young because, it was a hard 42 because – he had lived a tough life, with all the drugs and the substances and stuff, and he wasn't in the best of shape. Obviously, by the way he went out, with the impacted colon, causing him to drop on the throne, unfortunately.
Yeah. So Elvis Presley, obviously the big death in 1977 at the age of 42 in August. Quick final run before we move on. The Grammys were in February of 77. This is for the stuff from 76. Record of the year was The Masquerade by George Benson. Album of the year, Songs in the Key of Life by Stevie Wonder. Great album. Song of the year, I Write the Songs. Dr. G, you and I know that song very well. Sang very poorly, as a matter of fact. Best new artist was the Starland Vocal Band with their very innocent sounding song, Afternoon Delight. What's the delight to get in the afternoon? Anyway, that one best new artist.
So it's a Ron Burgundy favorite.
That's right. That's right. And if you disagree with me, I will fight you. Anyway, that's it for music in 1977. So, Mr. Atherton, let us now go to the big screen to wrap things up.
All right. So let's start off with the average price of a movie ticket in 1977, $2.25. you can't even get a soda for that, or a popcorn, or candy for that's half the price of candy. For fuck's sake, most candy is like $4.50 nowadays. But yeah, that's what it was like. And the Academy Awards held earlier that year in 1977 for the movie's release in 76. The most nominations was Network and Rocky had 10 each. Most wins, All the President's Men with 4 wins. Your hosts were Richard Pryor, Ellen Burstyn, Jane Fonda, and Warren Beatty. And the awards went to the best picture was Rocky, best director, John G. Avildsen for Rocky, best actor we spoke about earlier, Peter Finch for Network, best actress, Faye Dunaway for Network, best supporting actor, Jason Robards in All the President's Men, best supporting actress was Beatrice Strayford Network, best original screenplay was Patty Chayefsky for Network, and best adapted screenplay, All the President's Men, by William Goldman. Patty Chayefsky and William Goldman, if anybody who knows screenwriting, studies screenwriting, anything, are probably two of the biggest screenwriters of all time. Mm-hmm. In terms of, which you study and learning their method. Just incredible writers. We'll go through the top 10 in a minute, but some other movies released that year. Airport 77.
Great movie.
Eraserhead.
Strange movie.
Yes. The original Fun with Dick and Jane.
That is tremendous. Mm-hmm. That is tremendous. George Segal and Jane Fonda. Mm-hmm. Jane Fonda.
High Anxiety, one of my favorite.
Another great one.
I love the great Ron Carey as I forgot it was Brody or something. I got it. Yeah. I got it. I don't got it. And that great scene, the parody of the Birds, where Mel Brooks is just sitting there in the park, and all of a sudden he just starts getting shit on, all the pigeons and stuff. Nurse Ratched. Those who are late will not get through cup.
Harvey Korman. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Probably movie Scott's seen several times. The original Hills Have Eyes.
Fucking creepy as fuck.
Yeah. The remake
that came out, the remake that came out in the early 2000s is very, very, I have it on here in Studio B on Blu-ray. But the original was, is exceptional. One of the best, hidden horror movies of the late 70s. Yeah. Very good.
The Kentucky Fried Movie, which was yes. a bunch of shorts.
Fucking awesome. I love the one where the fucking gorilla beats the shit out of the fucking, the sex starved ape beats the shit out of the news people. That's so fucking awesome. That whole thing is just the most politically incorrect. Like, you couldn't play that now. People would lose their fucking minds if you tried to, like, play that in a theater now. Oh, my God. John Landis. Oh, mm-hmm. So goddamn good. Mm-hmm. Just utterly offensive and unbelievably delicious. Tremendous movie. Absolutely tremendous.
Looking for Mr. Goodbar.
That's a depressing one. Yeah.
It is a set. Yeah, it is really
and then
sad.
Starring the great Bo Derek, Orca, which was trying to kind of...
It wasn't about her.
Well, yeah, no, but yeah, it was trying
she gets
to...
She gets a leg chomped off.
By the killer whale, but it was trying to piggyback on Jaws, basically.
Yeah.
Yep. Horrible. Yep.
And what they do in Jaws 2? The opening scene, they have a dead killer whale that got fucked up by a great white.
Yep.
Yeah.
Fuck you, Orca.
And then one of my favorites back then as a kid, Pete's Dragon.
Pete's Dragon was awesome. Never should have been remade.
Yeah, it was.
Never should have been.
That was, oh my God. I took my kids to see that. That was a dull fucking movie.
Yeah, the original's tremendous. Helen Reddy, mm-hmm. Good music. Mm-hmm. Good music.
And then a little Pumping Iron.
Yes. Every time I pump, it's like humming every time.
Yeah, that's what he is such.
I'm quoting Arnold. He says it's like a cum. You feel it. You feel your muscle.
He is
humming every time.
He is such a fucking asshole in that movie. Such an asshole. Yeah. Lou Ferrigno is like the greatest baby face in the history of movies. In that movie, is Lou. Lou is awesome. Arnold is such a douchebag in that movie. Such a douchebag. Sitting around smoking pot in the fucking locker room and everything. Oh my God. He is such a heel in that movie, Arnold. Such a heel.
And then a kind of like one of the more underrated Disney animated classics, The Rescuers.
You know, The Rescuers has a nude scene in it.
It does?
Oh my God, yeah.
Yes. There's a scene. John, you remember the scene I'm talking about, right?
On the video or something?
Yeah.
On the videotape, something got spliced in there?
Yeah, there's a scene where the two birds are going through New York City, and one of the Disney people did this all the time back in the day, because they were bored probably. Mm-hmm. They're going through, and if you pause the tape fast enough, there one of the windows in the buildings behind the two mice is a woman with naked tits. So it's on the video if you can pause it fast enough, but it's controversial in the history of The Rescuers.
Well, yeah, but there's a bunch of those out there. Some of them may be urban legends. Like there's
One's not. If you go on the wiki page, I think the video is actually embedded.
Oh, well,
there is some urban legends, yes, yeah, but that one's real.
Getting to see Jessica Rabbit's snatch,
yes,
on the laser disc, where I guess when she gets thrown from Benny the cab, if you pause it at the right place, you know.
But yes, if you pause the spot. When the mice are in the carriage, you could see a set of knockers sticking out the window. So
there you go.
Yep.
For your research pleasure. And also Slapshot. Great.
Oh, fucking awesome. That was I relate to that because that's the New Haven Nighthawks right there. So I relate to that movie very well.
All right, and then the top 10 at the domestic box office. At number 10, we had Annie Hall. Very funny.
Har 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 har.
With Paul Simon, my favorite scene is when they have the Coke and he's Woody Allen sneezes and probably blows about a few hundred dollars worth of Coke into the air.
Yeah.
Great Diane Keaton performance as well. Number 9, Oh God, featuring George Burns.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah. That was pretty good. Yeah, it was pretty good. John Denver.
Then they went.
You don't oil your cukes.
Winchester would say. A couple of bad sequels. But they had Oh God Book 2 and then Oh God You Devil.
Oh God Book 2 wasn't bad with the little girl. Oh God You Devil is terrible. But Oh God Book 2 wasn't bad with the little girl.
Mm-hmm.
And then, Shinju.
There you go, Scott. A Bond movie, number 8, The mm-hmm. Spy Who Loved Me.
Saved the franchise mm-hmm. the first time. It was the first Bond movie where Albert Broccoli was sole producer.
And it was a big struggle. This one had to succeed, and it did. Marvin Hamlisch did the soundtrack. Of course, Carly Simon did the lead song. Nobody Does It Better. It's a top 10 of the 24 Bonds. It's a top 10. Mm-hmm. Probably top 5 in some people's eyes.
And you had number 7 was The Deep, which I've never seen, but
Robert Shaw, Jacqueline Bisset.
Biting off jaws. Yeah,
they
tried to
bite off jaws. Is it Nick Nolte or somebody?
Yeah, Nick Nolte, yep.
Yep, great movie.
Number 6 was A Bridge Too Far.
A British war epic. Mm-hmm. Like every great British actor is in it. Mm-hmm. And Sean Connery, because he's Scottish. Michael Caine, bunch of other great British actors.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Number 5 was The Goodbye Girl.
Richard Dreyfuss.
Yeah. Marcia Mason. My mom made me sit through that.
Mm-hmm. And then as we get to the top 4, you know, after we go through this, I put it out there. Find me a top 4 that you could put this top 4 up against any top 4 movies of any year and see what mm-hmm. happens.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I like the variety of them too.
We're all over the place. So at number 4, Saturday Night Fever, starring John Travolta. Very talk about very New York.
Gee, how many times you and I walked down that sidewalk? Many times.
Yes, that's the old neighborhood right there.
Carrying pink hands.
Eating Lenny's Pizza. Mm-hmm. Hey, we were at Lenny's Pizza. Yep. Good pie still. Good pie.
All right. And then number 3 was Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Directed by Steven Spielberg, starring Richard Dreyfuss.
Fantastic movie.
Number 2, one of my favorite comedies, even though I didn't understand a lot of the jokes as a kid, Smokey and the Bandit.
A Valentine's Day special at the University of New Haven.
Yeah.
We used to sit in our newspaper office on Valentine's Day and get drunk watching Smokey and the fucking Bandit. Drinking champagne. We didn't drink beer. Now, we were very high class at our school. We drank champagne. Okay.
Ooh, we didn't drink beer bottles on the floor.
We were hoi. We were like Judge Smales. How can you argue with anything in that movie? Anything. It makes me like drinking Coors now. You know,
as great as Burt Reynolds, Jerry Reed are. This is Jackie Gleason's movie. I'm sorry. Yep. Just having that cigarette the entire movie. The cigarette was like almost a character because he had to have it. And he had to hold it a certain way. And this, his lines, he's like, you know, he's just like, you know, what you call it? Hey, daddy, look at that alligator. It reminds me, Junior, I got to call your mama.
Hope your goddamn head was in it. We have a friend. We had a guy we went to college with, and Dr. G and I have talked about him all the time. He literally – this was literally – would you say literally his favorite movie of all time?
Oh, no doubt.
Literally his favorite movie of all time. And every Valentine's Day, he wanted to watch it. So we used to wheel it – we used to borrow a TV and a VCR from the audiovisual department, and we would watch –
how great our lives were, huh?
And And I mean, Daddy, can you stay watch the game? Or you stay watch the game. I'm going back.
Buford T. Justice from Texarkana, Texas. I'm on hot pursuit.
I want to find a Diablo sandwich. Damn it!
I'm gonna barbecue your ass and molasses, well, Junior. If you ever embarrass me like that again, I'm gonna take an axe so you never have to open that fly. Your mama was in the Klan. People thought she was an iceberg going down the road.
God. Arguably one of them. Just so great. Primo Burt Reynolds right there. Primo Burt Reynolds.
Junior, when we get home, I'm going to punch your mama in the mouth.
God.
My favorite is, you sounded a lot taller on the radio.
Bird. Thank you,
Kylie. Come on, Fred! Sounds like Dusty.
What the hell is the goddamn world coming to?
A guy from Brooklyn playing someone from the South. That's the best part. And he did a great job at it.
Yes, he did. Absolutely did. I actually have the 3-pack of movies on DVD. I have all three of them. We'll get to the others down the line.
And he's one of those guys, man. He just lived the way he wanted to live. Didn't give a shit. He just wanted to enjoy life. And when it was his time, it was his time.
And well, you saw it where he made his money down in Florida. He bought a mm-hmm. lot of land mm-hmm. down in South Florida when it was still like the Everglades and all that stuff. And he sold a lot of that land. He lived not too far from where I lived when I lived down in Florida, and he donated a lot of his money and his. He had like a gigantic library in his house. He donated it to the University of Miami when he passed.
Wow, tremendous! So, and then the number one movie of 1977, and probably the number one movie to a lot of us growing up. The original now wasn't called, didn't have a subtitle at the time. It was just called simply Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. You know, and I mentioned it earlier in the show. Amazing that this franchise or this story, this saga, has been going on since 1977, and it's going to wrap up later this year.
Mm-hmm.
9 movies later, some gaps and some highs and some lows, but amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Now, Scott, we're going to talk about this quite a bit coming up over the next couple of months here at Place Your Nation. Because, how can we not? The end of the mm-hmm. Skywalker saga is coming. But, just give some general thoughts on the 77 Star Wars original release.
Well, what's funny is, and again, I'll paraphrase, and I seriously will. Because we're going to get more into this. Andy's right. We're going to, just to give you a preview, we're going to do a big special series across all shows in the Place to Be Nation pop feed, discussing the legacy that is the Star Wars franchise, as we get to episode 9 on December 20th. But you have to remember, back in those days, other than maybe 2001 A Space Odyssey, space movies were not sci-fi was not a big thing back then. Space movies were for kids. Kiddie movies. Disney did space movies. The 70s were all very serious. The French Connection, Death Wish, rogue guys killing scumbags. Right up Dr. G's alley. And, movies where you just clean the streets of pieces of shit. And anti-heroes. And George Lucas, old Turkey Jowls himself, wanted to have a movie reminiscent of his old, Buck Rogers, Buster Crab serials of the 30s and 40s when he was a kid. And that's what Star Wars was. And he got lucky and made a success with American Graffiti. And 20th Century Fox gave him – fronted him the cash. And he made – he had a trilogy written all along. But he knew that he only could do a third of it first. And that's where Star Wars started. And it just blew the minds of everyone because, again, and I think it's the same as going into TV – we were done with serious. We were tired of being lectured and leaned on. The world sucks, and there's racism, and there's this. And we were tired of getting slapped in the face. We wanted to go back to using movies and TV as entertainment instead of as commentary and lecture. We were getting tired of that. We were getting worn out, and that's why Star Wars was so great, because it took you to a galaxy far, far away. And I spent the next 42 years of my life, making a part of my childhood and beyond. And I think that's a lot of people's take. And I'll get more into this, Andy, both when we do our winter, fall, Christmas preview of movies on the pop feed, and when we do our series later in the year on the franchise as a whole. But it was a game changer for movies. And it set the tone for what movies would be like for the next 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's why it was what it was. But in general, I don't want to belabor the point about Star Wars, because we'll get more into that down the line. But John is right. I mean, you have a music drama, two sci-fis, and a comedy in the top four. I mean, and all of them could be construed as world heavyweight champions of movies. I mean, you could slip any of those in the number one, and I wouldn't complain at all. So that's what made 1977 a great year for movies. Bond, Star Wars. I mean, everything was in my wheelhouse and all our wheelhouses. So the Kentucky Fried Movie, I mean, come on. I highly recommend watching that if anybody who's never seen Kentucky Fried Movie. It is thoroughly offensive, but fuck it, who cares? It's that funny. I know John's seen it. Dr. G, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but you and I watch it. John, I know you've probably seen it. It's fucking hilarious. But anyway, 1977.
Yes, and Slapshot is one of the, you know, it goes down as one of the greatest sports films of all time.
Damn right it is.
We can go on for hours about that. That's a classic.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It is a funny.
So, there we go.
Yeah. You guys, I know John and G aren't the biggest Star Wars guys, but you guys got any thoughts?
I mean, I did see it. It was and I had all the Star Wars figures and all that stuff, but I didn't stay with it. I mean, I saw Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, but after that, not really much.
Yeah, I just remember just the fever that took a hold of everybody and how big an event it became when the next two came out. I remember as a kid, I mean, I was lucky. I think I got the Death Star playset, I think, for Christmas that year. I mean, I had a bunch of figures. I remember later on getting more things. I did have a Millennium Falcon, I believe. But yeah, it was the merchandising alone, you know, is what made it. And then you could see all of George's influences from, you know, the Japanese cinema, Samurai, the World War II films, with the trench run and all that stuff. And just everybody wanted to be Luke Skywalker or Han, you know. Scott, who shot first, Han or Greedo?
Han, and I'm proud of it. He should have. He was going to get assassinated. Fuck you, Greedo.
Watasita solo, chabatite. Hell.
Yes, I'll bet you have. Tisakadu la chaska. I'll quote more of that crap down the line. We're not going to bore these guys with it now, but
yes.
Anyway.
Like Scott alluded to, yes, coming up on the PlayStation Pop feed with episode 9 of the Rise of Skywalker, right? That's what it's called.
Yes, the Rise of Skywalker.
It's late. Coming, we're going to be doing Star Wars Month. And we have, talked to the Brethren hosts here. And, yes, across all of our shows, you'll be seeing Star Wars-centric themed episodes. And hope to be a lot of fun. But before that, as we're closing out tonight's show, we have something else coming. Another theme month in October. Scott, yeah, you want to talk about that for a second?
Well, yes, we'll talk very quickly about it. We are getting into September, and we get to Labor Day, and we'll probably start in mid-September as we get through all of October, but we are going to do a lot of Halloween and horror and, you know, monster movie centric shows and articles on PlaysMeNation.com and the Pop feed. You're going to see a lot of Pop Goes the Movies, from even going back as Bela Lugosi's Dracula, Boris Karloff's Frankenstein. We're going to do shows about the Holy Trinity of slasher, In the Name of the Michael, and I know G's going to hit me because I'm using Catholic here, but In the Name of the Michael and of the Jason and of the Holy Freddy, amen. We're going to talk about Scream. We're going to talk about Blair Witch. Everything horror, Halloween, monster movies, you name it. We're going to talk about it and write about it on PlayStation Nation Pop feed throughout mid to late September and almost all of October. So stay tuned for that. You'll get your Halloween and trick or treating down pat here on the feeds. So stay tuned for that. We'll talk more about that, Andy, in the upcoming shows. But we're gonna have a lot of fun with that. Getting your monster movies on.
Yeah, Johnny, what do you got coming up here in PlaysMe Nation?
We just have another edition of ECW just dropped episode 3 of the three-way dance, getting a lot of nice compliments on that with the king and the queen of Place to Be Nation. And as spoken before, in a couple weeks we'll be having the NFL preview with This Week in the NFL with me and the Cowboy. Although you and Scott kind of got some of got a sneak peek at some of his predictions and insights, but I'll get a little more out of him, and you get to hear my shitty predictions in a couple weeks. So we'll get that in a couple days before the opening day, the Thursday, the 5th.
Awesome, George. We'll see you back here in 1978.
Great, looking forward to it.
Scott. I think we're going to have the doctor on a future main event. I think you're due to come back on, doctor. Maybe I'll have you on after the premiere of AEW on TNT, because I'd like to have a fresh perspective on the new show. So maybe we'll have you on a future main event in the next month or so, at some point in the next couple months, because being the objective viewer that you are. So Dr. G's return to main event will be very soon. So stay tuned for that. There you go. I just booked you right alive on the air. How about that, huh? Well, breaking the fourth wall. Oh. Like Mr. Roper. Now you can do the funny smile. There you go.
Scott, what else you got coming up?
Oh, Jesus Christ. Well, we did Looking Forward, Looking Back, the sports edition. As John mentioned last night, we did this show. Main Event is recording tomorrow. We're going to look at some stuff going on around wrestling involving AEW and TNT going to USA, et cetera, et cetera. We'll have our New Japan Classic match picks for the week. Next Monday, Mr. Winston will join my PIC, Mr. Rosero, and the King yourself here as we do the next installment of the Place B podcast, the November 25th, 1989, Saturday night's main event. So stay tuned for that next week, plus a myriad of other crap down the line. So busy month for me and a busy month for both the pop and wrestling feed. So stay tuned.
Awesome, awesome. And far as for me, like we've talked about, the Looking Forward, Looking Back sports edition. That was the one and only sports edition I am hosting. I have handed the reins over to the Cowboy for those episodes coming up. There's only going to be a few a year, but I figure let's get somebody who actually knows a little bit about sports, a lot more about sports than I do, to shepherd those shows. So look forward to those coming up. And regular Looking Forward, Looking Back, the movie editions. That's right. We have the fall and winter movie preview. So far, Jenny Smith and Tim Capel are booked. And Scott, you may make an appearance on that as well. Mm-hmm. So talk a little episode 9. Mm-hmm. And then coming up in September, we have the big summer movie wrap-up and the summer movie wager results show for Looking Forward, Looking Back. And we find out, you know, who was the best at predicting the domestic box office. Was it me? Was it Scott? Was it Miranda? Jenny? Russell or Tim. Also, we had a few other people that participated but didn't go on the show, so they're not going to get roped into the live watch coming down the road. Jenny and I are going to get together for a freak out drive-in coming up to get in tune with a new release coming in October, and also look for new episodes of Laughing Theater coming, as well as a great debate hopefully coming in September. So I want to thank the crew for being here tonight, my co-host Scott, John, and G, as usual, as their awesome jobs with their great analysis of the 70s, 1977, is in the books. So we'll talk to you guys later, and we'll see you in 1978. Take care, everybody.
Chocolate. Fucking chocolate.
Oh, God.